This is Kim Sawyer conducting an oral history interview with Frank G. Stone III on March 21st, 2001 at 10:05 in the morning. We are in the Special Collections Library at Texas Tech University. Mr. Stone, could you begin by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself, where you were born, where you grew up?
I was born in Big Run, Pennsylvania, which is about 100 miles northeast of Pittsburgh, 7 miles away from Punxsutawney, which is home of the groundhog. I grew up and graduated from Punxsutawney High School in 1958. I then went to Penn State at an undergraduate center in Du Bois, Pennsylvania. For a little while, I got sick, had to drop out. Then I went on to, I worked on road construction for about 5 months with an outfit called Interstate Amosite Corporation. And when I completed with that, I went on to Kansas City, Missouri, and attended a school, an electronics school, called Central Technical Institute, which is no longer. The address was at 16th and Wyandotte Streets in downtown Kansas City. And as I said, I've got a friend living near there. He said it's no longer in existence. But I went through that and graduated, and I had a ticket in broadcast technology. So I got an assignment or a job in Aberdeen, Maryland, as a disc jockey and an engineer for the radio station, which they are required to have, since they had to have so many first-class FCC tickets on hand at any given moment. It was there that I started meeting recruiters. And a little background, I had built model airplanes ever since I was old enough to know what an airplane was. And I always wanted to fly. And I was in a position at that time where I felt like the draft was going to be breathing on my neck pretty quick. So after consultation with my uncle, who was I think he was a first lieutenant in the Army at that time, he suggested, yes, I go for something, whatever I might like to do. Mm-hmm. So all the armed forces recruiters would come into the station and bring pies from the mess hall and everything, trying to bribe me to go ahead and play their spots for recruiting more often on the air. And one of those was the Air Force recruiter. And we got to talk and told him I always wanted to fly. And he suggested that I try to get into the aviation cadet program. And so he arranged for it. I took the time off, went down to Bowling Field near Washington, and I took a series of tests, and didn't know the results for a long time, but through him I completed all the applications and everything for the cadet program. Then I quit my job, and I went back, spent the summer with my mother in Rhode Island, and just laid on the beach and became a real beach bum for the summer. Got a good tan and had a lot of fun. And then I decided, well, I had to make a move. I hadn't heard from the Air Force, so I went ahead and enlisted. So I went to Lackland for basic training, and while I was in basic training, the word came down that I had been selected for the cadet program. So I completed basic, and shortly thereafter went on to James Connolly Air Force Base in Waco, Texas, now closed, and proceeded through the cadet program. It was I couldn't get into the pilot cadet program because they were phasing that out at the time, but I did manage to make it into the navigator cadet program. So I think I started that toward the end of November.
Is this 1961?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I went in the program, and it was about 11 months, roughly, of it was a typical cadet program. People screaming in your face all the time, and you're running and jumping up in the middle of the night for fire drills and all this sort of thing. That lasted for a year and 11 months, as I said earlier. And then several of my friends and I, we had to go, all of us went through survival school at Stead Air Force Base, Nevada, which is just north of Reno, and that's in my bio, I think. The survival school, it was rather interesting because it was in November, and of course that's high altitude and ferocious weather up there, but it was, when I got there, I was in pretty good shape. I was about 150 pounds, and of course we had constant PT while I was in cadets, so I was able to stay in real good shape, and we ate well. But we got up there, and outside we had to jog everywhere. We were in fatigues and combat boots, and so we had to run everywhere between classes to stay in shape, because some of those guys coming into survival school were older, more pudgy types that definitely needed the training. So we finally, the three-week course culminated in the trek, and I was out in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and it was, as I said, November, and that place is very prone to a lot of snow at that time. So my buddy and I, Joe Simpson, we paired up together, and oh Lord, about the first night out, it snowed 2 to 3 feet, and all we had was a little ejection sheet, survival tin of rations, and they came across with an occasional rabbit, and we had additional, at the beginning of the trek, we were in groups of about six, and they gave us the rabbit, so the city guys had to kill the rabbit and clean it, you know, and then we all cooked it, and that wasn't any problem for me, since I grew up hunting and shooting and everything. That was just a part of life for me, but some of the city guys had never even held a rabbit, let alone killed it, so that was kind of interesting. But we went through, and we managed to make it, and when I got out of, off the trek, I've got a picture at home that shows what we looked like, and we looked in bad shape.
How long was this for, the trek?
The trek was, as I recall, about 5 days, as I recall. And they came across with an occasional orange or an apple or, you know, like I said, a rabbit. But mainly we were surviving on the rations out of that seat pack. And I had lost, when I got back to the, of course, I just threw those fatigues that I was in the garbage because they were in such horrible shape. But I lost, I was down to 133 pounds when I got off that track. And just lack of food, high altitude, dehydration factor, and so on. And a comical side note, we had been going to a little Italian restaurant down in the northern part of Reno to eat quite often. And when we got off the trek, we went down there, and we were starving. But of course, at that time, our stomachs had shrunk to the point where they're the size of walnuts. And that poor Mamma Mia saw us come in the door, and she almost fainted. You know, we all looked like walking skeletons. And she plunked us down, and she proceeded to bring the food. Of course, we couldn't eat nearly all of it. And then it was nearing the holidays, and she had made some spumoni for their family, which is an Italian ice cream. And so we topped it off with some of that special stuff she had saved for her family. And I thought that was just really, really nice. Another side note on survival school was in our initial group, we had a Danish officer. And I had met with Danes earlier on when I was a navigator, or later on when I got assigned to Dover. But we were down, I found out from Finn, was his name, all the officers, mainly pilots, I guess, in the Danish Air Force at that time had three-letter names, and he was Finn. And of course, later on, when I was broken wheels for that week, why, and that's Tripoli, in case you're wondering, I ran across all the Danes. They were down there for their annual shoot up the sands fighter pilot drill that they normally went through. And I went in and said, "Hi, I've got a friend named Finn. Anybody know?" So everybody had a three-letter name, and everybody knew everybody else because it was a small Air Force. But he was really a mess. We went to Reno one night. He thought he was going to be the heavy gambler, and so he lost his money, and I got a parking ticket in an alley. So we had, and my Porsche at that time that I had was towed off somewhere, so we had to go rescue it. But anyway, after survival school, then we drove back cross country and pulled off in Texas, dropped off my friend Jim True, who later on retired as full colonel. He was a 30-year man, and he stayed as a navigator, but he got his degree and master's along the way and became a finance officer. And he's now a professor at a college down in, I think, Beaumont. So came home on leave for the holidays and then reported into Dover, Delaware at the 39th Air Transport Squadron, ATS, in the, at that time, Military Air Transport Service, or MATS, and I was assigned to fly 133s, and which was, in the vernacular, was known as the Oscar Mayer Weenie Wagon, because it was a big airplane.
Is it also known as the Cargo Master? Is that the same aircraft?
Yeah. That's correct. Mm-hmm. I've got a model of it, a cast iron model of it, and a picture of it. I think it was in the spring of 65, they had a string of 133s that simply dropped out of the air for no apparent reason and killed everybody on board. So they came up with some ideas, and they grounded them for about 5 months during the middle portion of that year. And so the navigators, of course, pilots were dead in the water. They just got odd jobs around the base, but navigators were farmed out almost all over every base that needed a navigator got one from Dover or Travis at that time. The A model 133s were at Dover, the B models were at Travis. And the difference was, on the A model we had a 130 type rear door setup like this. And the B models at Travis, they went a little about 10 knots faster, and a little different instrumentation. But they had clamshell rear doors, and they were able to haul the big missiles that were stored at Hill Air Force Base at that time. So they spent a lot of time on alert to haul missiles, whereas we got the trash hauling around the world. But at any rate, I did a couple of things. I wound up initially at McGuire Air Force Base, and I had a friend in a 118 squadron, and this was at the time when Matz was in the passenger business, and so he got me on a couple of runs with him. I went to a round trip to Germany a couple times, and then he got me on a trip down to through Recife, Brazil, to Ascension Island, which is out in the middle of the Atlantic, about 10 degrees south latitude. And it was the southernmost radar tracking site on the Atlantic Missile Range.
Okay.
And it was maintained by the British, and it's just a volcanic rock. But we went out there and came on back. And I had been there in a 133 also, broken for about 9 days, and that was very interesting. But
you were moving people and troops? Or equipment?
In the 118s, it was all people.
All people.
Yeah. And then, of course, we came through Recife, Brazil, and crew rested each way. And but the 118 trips, it was just strictly people. And we flew in Class A uniforms, and that was, just like an airline business.
Okay.
But then I managed to, other than the 118s, I flew a lot of 124s. During that period. I remember one trip in particular. Somehow I wound up at Hickam, and there's a 124 coming through there. And I remember it was really interesting because the crew, now there weren't two crew members on that airplane from the same base. I mean, it was a composite of everywhere there's a 124 squadron, they had a crew member on there. So the two pilots were from different bases, the engineers from crew, loadmasters were all from different bases, and I was the only navigator, and I hated 124s because they were low, they were slow, and took forever to get anywhere. But anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. And all during this time that I was assigned at Dover, I think my first trip into Vietnam was in February of 63. And even then, we landed at Tan Son in Saigon, and the whole airfield was full of little green airplanes and people in green uniforms running around. This is February of 63. And I thought, boy, and it just grew after that. I made it in about once a month during my whole tour at Dover, and the place was just really had a lot of Army people there, and advisors, mm-hmm. and Army helicopters, airplanes, what have
you. How close had you been following the buildup during that time?
I really hadn't. I was a young bachelor at that time, mainly interested in chasing women. So, and we had a good place to do it because we went down to the Rehoboth Beach and Dewey Beach there in Delaware. Mm-hmm. And so we really weren't that history inclined at that time. Mm-hmm. But it was, but I just noticed this, and we got into Da Nang, and let's see, I can't remember. Those were the two main places because we're flying such big airplanes, and most of the other locations did not have the ground equipment necessary to unload or offload. Mm-hmm. So Tan Son and Da Nang were the two main points into which we flew.
And you were hauling equipment at this point, or also more people, advisors?
People and equipment.
Okay.
And during the times, I remember one trip in particular. We had a load of Jeeps in that 133. And as I said, the 133 is a big airplane. It had about 90-some feet of usable cargo space. It was extremely wide, extremely high. Uh-huh. And watching that thing offload there at Tan Son with all those Jeeps, just like a big old guppy giving birth, you know. It never seemed to stop.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we took helicopters and moved them to others. So.
And how long would that trip typically take, and where would you stop?
Oh, wow. Well, we had to island hop going out. We'd fly Travis to Hickam, crew rest, Travis to Wake, or Hickam to Wake, crew rest there. That was one of the better crew rest spots out in the Pacific, by the way.
Wake Island?
Wake Island, yeah. It was run by an outfit contract by Zaire Facilities Management Corporation, FMC. And all the housekeeping duties, like running the chow hall and mm-hmm. taking care of the BOQs and so on, was done by Filipinos.
Okay.
And and I'm hoping some other people that might have been in the transporter business will back me up on this, but they had a bar there called the Drifter's Reef. Now, I got to describe the Drifter's Reef because it was really interesting. It was a shack. And it had old airplane parts stacked up against the side, a leaky tin roof. It was just as you would picture a South Sea Island bar.
Mm-hmm.
A big old horseshoe bar inside from the Philippines, and they had this humongous big nude painting on the back wall. But the interesting thing about that place was that it was so shoddy. But you could go over there and have a beer and watch the sun go down over the Pacific. And it was a sight I'll never forget. But Wake Island was an interesting story in itself. But we would stop there. And then sometimes we weren't too heavy. We could make it onto Clark from Wake. Mm-hmm. But most of the times we had to go through Guam and refuel. Mm-hmm. And then on to Clark and then on to Vietnam. And then come back very either mid-pack back across or Okinawa or Tachikawa.
You said you would fly at least once a month to Vietnam during this
yes.
time period?
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a lot of selfishness in that. Everybody tried to get on at least one trip a month because of the income tax deduction.
Oh, okay.
Enlisted people paid no income tax for the month they were in the war zone.
Okay.
And then officers got a $500 deduction. And of course, in today's dollars, that wouldn't be much, but in those days' dollars, it was significant.
Okay.
And then we would hopscotch on back to, and a lot of times we would leave Tachikawa and we would fly to Midway Island. And I don't know whether you've heard very much about Midway Island, but it was the home of the Goonie Birds. And there are a lot of stories came out about Goonie Birds. It was just hilarious.
Do you have any, for example?
Well, yeah. One, some I observed, but one of the more interesting ones was we had this World War II major as an aircraft commander in the 39th Squadron at Dover. And he was telling us about the time when he was flying 124s, and he and his crew went out there. They crew rested, and they went out and were pre-flighting this old 124, and there's a Goonie Bird sitting out there on the wing. And Goonie Birds don't get perturbed at anything. I mean, you can walk up to them, and they're just not afraid of people. But this old goon sat there and watched everybody do their pre-flight thing. And he was out, I guess, near the end of the wing. Well, they cranked up the engines and taxied on out, and the old goon just sat there and looked very unruffled. And they went out the end of the runway and ran up the engines per the checklist, and the old goon just sitting there watching. And pretty soon he starts going down the runway, you know. And as they start going faster, the old goon starts leaning into the wind, you know. And almost before liftoff, the old goon got too much for him, off the end. It was truly hilarious. My first visit to Midway, I went down to the beach, and I was just looking at it. I always savored the beach, the sounds, it was watching the birds, the seagulls and everything. Well, there was Goonie Birds, and they're very clumsy when they're near the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this golden retriever out there having more fun than the law should allow. And what he'd do was the beach was sloped into several little tidal levels. And he would wait until a Goonie Bird went flopping down the beach to try and get airborne. And he picked just the right time, because just before the goon had quite enough airspeed to become airborne, he would run after it barking. And the goon would try and leap into the air, flap, 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 and go splash into the water every time. And I thought, boy, whoever thought of doggy intelligence really had to witness that one. That dog had figured out, you know, just the right time. I watched him do it several times, so it just wasn't a one-time accident. But there's a lot of Goonie Bird stories, and it's just hilarious. But then we would then fly from Midway on straight back to Travis, and it was a long run, but normally at that latitude we had pretty good tailwinds in that direction, so we were able to make it. Okay. While I was at Dover, about a year before I left, I had applied for, you had to be in the cockpit as a navigator so many years, I forget how many that was right now. I think it was 3 years. I might be mistaken, but I went ahead and applied for pilot training. I felt kind of disillusioned because we had some very, very sharp people there at Dover in the nav department to apply, and they were turned down. But I thought, well, what the hell? So I went ahead and applied. And the first time I'd taken an AFOQT at Bowling, apparently I scored real high on the pilot portion of that test.
AFOQT?
Armed Forces Officer. Maybe it wasn't the AFOQT. It was an aircrew and officer test. Yeah, okay. So it had to be that Air Force Officer Qualification
okay.
test. And apparently, the pilot portion I scored very high because that got me into pilot training. So I came down to Reese in my last trip into Vietnam with the 39th at Dover was in May of 66, and my pilot training class started June of 66. And so then I came down to dear Dusty Reese and got into pilot training. I felt very fortunate. I had good instructors, and the T-38 had been in place out at Reese for somewhere between 2 and 3 years when I got here. So I was able to fly the T-38, which is definitely more fun than law should allow. So pilot training went pretty well. This is where I discovered I had allergies. It's coming to Reese. And after Reese, I was in a dilemma when it came to assignments. The adventuresome part of me wanted to go to fighters. The more practical side of me was telling me I needed to go back to transports. And they had a 133 slot open at Dover. And I was very, very tempted, but the adventuresome part of me went out and I applied for and got F4s. The unfortunate thing about that assignment was I got stuck in the back seat. And shortly after graduation from pilot training, I got married. And she was a tech student at that time working on her master's in Spanish. But anyway, we got married, and I first initially had to go to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson for a 6-week backseat radar school in the F-4. And we went out there, and that was really our honeymoon out there. And we got a little apartment, had a swamp cooler on it. Smelled musty all the time. I really didn't care for it. But anyway, didn't do any flying out there, just strictly simulator type stuff. And then we went on to MacDill Air Force Base in Florida at Tampa. And I started into that program. It was a hellacious program because we were going 6 days a week right from the start. And the F-4 was a kind of a complicated airplane to learn, try and learn in such a hurry. And so I was teamed up with a guy that had been come from Europe. He had been a helicopter pilot, broken a leg. The guy was built like a gorilla. He was a real hefty weightlifter and so on. But he got the front seat, and I was teamed with him. And we're about halfway through the program. Let me back up a little bit. As I said, we were going from early morning to late in the evening, 6 days a week, and that in itself was pretty exhausting.
Did you have classroom training?
Classroom training and then just lots of other things. We didn't get a ride in the airplane for the first week or two, and that was with an instructor in the front seat. But like I said, it was kind of a complicated airplane to learn, especially, such an arm loaded all at once. If you were trickled into it a little more gradually, it would have been far more, made a lot more sense. But anyway, it was difficult to learn all that because we needed study time and we were out at the base so often, and it was just 10 to 12 hours a day. About halfway through the program, we were going to the gunnery range at Kissimmee, Avon Park, Florida, Central Florida, South Central, down below Kissimmee. We're just south of Disney World and so on. We were number four in a four ship, and for some reason we had a little problem before we took off. And the other, we were number four, as I said. So the 1, 2, and 3 went ahead and took off, and we got off the ground, and we were in a C model F-4. And this is significant because of the type of ejection seat it had. But after liftoff, the main gear would not come up. And this guy in the front seat really didn't have enough experience to cope with that aircraft in that situation, because under 250 knots, as heavy as we were, we're going to the range, so we had full of fuel, lots of practice ordnance, and a gun center line. So we were heavy and we were dirty, had a lot of stuff hanging. So the main gear did not come up, so mobile control advised us of that fact, and so we were coming over the top and he pulled it out of burner, because the gear limit speed was about 200 knots, we were already over that. And so he pulled out of burner, we're kind of coasting over the top, and I had my checklist under my leg, and I was reaching to get that. About that time, he said, we're going in, get out. And what had happened was, the aircraft started rolling at about 200 knots. And the angle of attack was so high that you had to actually fly the airplane with the rudders only. Because if you tried to use a stick, you got an adverse effect in that it would increase the roll you were trying to come out of. And he forgot all that. And so he tried to correct with a stick, which is a natural inclination. But he wasn't remembering airspeed and the fact he just had to hit the left rudder to bring us out of that roll. Well, we were about 60 degrees. He told me to get out. So I took one flash, and I had mentally programmed myself the Martin Baker seat in the F4 had two methods of ejecting. One was a handle between the legs, mm-hmm. and it had stirrups down below to keep your feet in and so on. Okay. It was built for high speed, high altitude ejections. The other way was a face curtain that you had to reach up and grab two handles and pull down over your face. I had more or less programmed myself out of using that second method because I was afraid, as narrow as the cockpit was, that I would have my elbows too far out and I would lose them when I went out. So I pulled the handle and it was a boot in the butt. It was 18 G's instantaneously. Now, the reason I said it was significant that it was a C model was it was a strictly ballistic seat. It had the equivalent, according to the Martin Baker people, of an 88 millimeter shell in the seat. And it's from nothing to 18 G's, 18 times your own body weight, in just a split second, compressed three vertebrae in my back. I got compression fractures on the inner edges. And one of the reasons for that was I was bent over a little bit. So I went out and I thought, I didn't want to forget this, you know, so I tried to keep my eyes open. There was no way I could do that. And a split second later, bam, I was stretched out again when the chute opened, because it was a 28 foot fast open canopy. And so then Freddie, as I learned later, got out at about 120 degrees, and he was built, like I said, as a gorilla, so that seat didn't bother him at all. But I noticed from my just talking around afterwards, the people that had ejected, that had gotten injured, were people with a lighter bone structure. And I only weighed about 150 pounds at that time, plus all the gear. So for that ejection seat, it was, you know, like nothing was in the seat at all. But the guy in the front seat, he weighed a lot more. He was a very bulky, muscular guy, and he had a large bone structure. So he didn't get injured at all. But
this was over
Tampa Bay.
Tampa Bay.
We took off to the north up over the bay. And so I remember as soon as the chute opened, you know, wow. So I kind of looked around, and first thing I did was disconnect my oxygen mask and let it hang. And I looked down, and it's really wild how what the mind comes across when you're in a situation like that, because the first thing I looked at all that water coming at me, and we're only a couple hundred feet, so no altitude to speak of, but all along Bay Shore Boulevard from Tampa into the base. They had signs all along. Polluted water, avoid all contact, McNeil Health Department. And I thought of that. So I went in and I didn't even have time. Well, I went in the water, bobbed back up because I had the G suit on and it must have had some air in it.
Okay.
And so I came back up, and first thing is we're programmed to do, disconnect the risers of the parachute, which I did. And as it so happened, there was a very strong undercurrent in Tampa Bay. And that parachute went down. I thought being so light it would float, but it didn't. It went down, and I had a couple shroud lines caught in one of my foot, on my right foot. And I remember to this day how you could just be looking at the instruction manual, picture by picture, everything you're supposed to do. Well, I reached down and got, we had a little pocket here in inside leg for that survival knife. And so I got it out, it was on a lanyard, untangled it, brought it up, unlocked it, pushed the button, boop, the blade came open, and I had a razor edge on it, and thank God I kept that knife sharp. And that's been with me to this day. Then I locked it, went underwater, one swipe, shroud lines were gone. So I brought it back up, unlocked it, pushed the button, pulled the knife shut, wound up the lanyard, stuck it back in the pocket, and I still got it. So then I thought, you know, well, I got my LPU, so I grabbed the little deals and pulled them, and so I was floating around, and then I, by the time I looked over Freddie, and he, you know, hollered over me, okay, yeah, I think so. And so then I said, well, I got a raft here somewhere, so I reached around. Of course, there's a lanyard tied to the parachute harness, and so I pulled it up, and there was the, it was a box, an actual, it was the seat, what we were on. And so they had it's a nice big handle, like an emergency brake handle. And I pulled that, and poof, you know, out came the raft, and everything worked as advertised. And so I crawled into it, and I'm bobbing around. About that time, what they had, the Air Force had some twin rotor inner deal helicopters, and their call sign was Pedro. And so Pedro came out, and they got over me, and so I slipped out of the raft into the water, and they lowered the harness, and I crawled into it and winched me on board, and then we went over and got the other guy. And came back, and after that it was a series of laying there with that cruddy water all over me, and we're in the emergency room, and must have been a string of about 6 or 8 full colonels sticking their face in mine. What happened? You know. And so, you know, I kind of
processed. What was Freddie's last name, do you recall? Is it?
I probably shouldn't mention it.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
But anyway, we went into the hospital, and we were in the same room. And then it was determined that I had the compression fracture. He wasn't injured, so he's in there overnight, and then he got out. And then I was in the hospital, and all this ties in at the same time the USS Pueblo was captured by North Korea. That's when I was in the hospital. And I remember seeing that on the television news and so on. But the stay in the hospital was somewhat uneventful. And everybody kept sneaking beer into me and some really high-priced hard stuff. So they made sure my stay in the hospital was comfortable. And the one thing about it, and this is a difference of people, but I remember this extremely well. Everybody from that squadron came up to see me at least once, except the squadron commander. I remember his name, but again, I won't mention it. But I thought that was really something. Earl wasn't in the hospital for 10 days, and the squadron commander never came to see me. And later on, he made full bird and went on to do different things, you know. But after that, I was grounded for 5 months, and at which time my wife and I never had a trip back to meet my side of the family, so we had us a new little Carnegie, and so we jumped in and went up, and I had a full colonel friend who was at that time at Langley, and I'd known him at Dover, and he was a Porsche nut, and so was I, so I stayed in touch with him, and we had interesting experiences together, but anyway, we went to Langley and spent a night or two with them, and then went on up to Dover and saw some of my old compadres, and my grandparents at that time lived in southern Maryland, a place called Cobb Island, Maryland, about 40 or 50 miles down Potomac River from D.C. Mm-hmm. And so we had some enjoyable days there, and then we went on up to New England to see my mother. Anyway, it was an interesting trip. We went to New York and mm-hmm. made like tourists and so on. And then got back and back to Florida, and I got back on flying status, and they were going to stick me right in the back seat again. And at that time, they were starting to put navigators in the back seat. And here I was, a pilot, right out of pilot training, they want to stick me in the back seat. And I said, I didn't think so. I want to be in command this time. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a screw up. I want to do it. So I went to, I talked with Randolph on the phone. Randolph Air Force Base at that time, Military Personnel Center. And so the only thing I could get as a pilot was to go support air control. So I was assigned to the O2 aircraft. We went up to Hurlburt Field, and we trained out a little auxiliary airfield out to the west of Hurlburt Field. And I can't remember the name of it to save my life, but we went out there, and that was where the main O2 checkout was. And my wife and I were very fortunate in that this little town, just practically nothing there, west of Fort Walton Beach, called Marietta, Florida. Mm-hmm. We had this lady that had this palatial estate. And we just happened to be sitting in the housing office when this guy that was moving out of this garage apartment in his place came in to tell him. So we're there at the right time. And so we managed to get that little apartment. It was beautiful. This lady had money coming out of her ears. And it was over the garage that housed her two Cadillacs. And the place was paneled in solid 3/4-inch walnut. And it had a solid stainless kitchenette there. And a solid, beautiful tile bathroom. It was just unbelievable. Had a balcony that overlooked the waterway out there over all this manicured grass. And wow. A little swimming pool. So my wife really didn't hurt for anything to do while I was off flying or doing my thing. So we had a good stay there. And then they were thinking they wanted to send me through survival school again. I said, no, I don't think so. And at that time, they had moved it to Washington State. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of reneged on that. But eventually, I got my orders, and I went on to Vietnam. I was initially assigned to Da Nang. But they wanted fighter-qualified people at that time. So this other slot came open down at Ben Hoa. That was the 19th Tactical Air Support Squadron at Ben Hoa, and it was the 20th TAS at Da Nang. So I volunteered for and got the assignment down to Ben Hoa. So I was assigned to Sleep Time Ops at Ben Hoa, and that was an interesting part of the story. So I think I'm going to pause for a minute, sure. Maybe.
You mentioned several times throughout your training working with people from other countries, other soldiers or officers. or you mentioned the Danish, for example, was that common to train with other?
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah, in pilot training out here, we had two Iranians in our group. The one in our half of the class, at that time we had split classes. In our side, we had this real sharp kid, Fatadun Arbab. So instantly, Freddie. And Freddie was kind of a neat guy. He flew pretty good, and but he did crazy things like when we were flying those little Cessnas up at Lubbock, Muni, prior to being Lubbock International. I remember old Freddie got a little confused, he said, and took off on a taxiway. Because the taxiways up there are just almost as big as a runway.
Yeah.
So he took off on a taxiway, and he really got chewed for that. But Freddie pulled some interesting stunts while we were there. But then in the other part of the class, they had this kid named Hashi Menasop. Hashi. And Hashi wasn't too smart. Because the Shah was paying for it at that time, they kept washing him back. I don't know whether he had graduated or not, but Freddie stayed with us, and he stayed right with our class, so he was pretty good. And then later on, when I was a squadron commander at Shepherd, I was living next to this full colonel and his wife and kids up at Burke Burnett, and it just so happened that he had an embassy job, Colonel Rogers, in Tehran, and he knew Freddie.
Oh, goodness.
And I said, is he still the skinny little runt he was when he was in pilot training? No, he had blossomed, shall we say. So I don't know what happened after the Shah fell, where he went. He probably got he and his family out of there, but I don't know where. I never heard from him again. The Danish officer, while I was a navigator at Dover, this is regression here, but we had a really good officers club at Dover during those years in the 60s. And we had this major come in to run. We had actual officers running the club at that time. His name was Sean. He made lieutenant colonel out of that job, but we had such a fabulous club. It was really the desired place in town to come to eat.
Really?
And of course it wasn't behind a gate. It was across the highway from the base, main part of the base, but it was over by the BOQs. Well, one dark, foggy night, I'm over there at the club, and like I say, I was a bachelor at that time, just over having a beer, and in walks this New Zealand crew. Now, they had come up in a 118 from Christchurch, and they were on a C-130 buying trip. And they were going into Andrews, but they couldn't get into Andrews because of the fog, so they had to divert over to Dover.
Mm-hmm.
So they walked in real hungry, but being typical New Zealanders, they were thirsty first and hungry second. So I met this whole crew in the bar, and I met the aircraft commander and the navigator and a couple of the other crew members. So I had a 64 Pontiac GTO at the time. So I said, well, they finished eating in here, but they were going to scrape something together for me. I said, I know a better place. So we went down to this other place. I forgot the name. It'll come to me later. But she specialized, and nearly half the bachelors on base went out there every night to eat, but chicken and dumplings. Typical good old American recipe. So I said, come on, I got a treat for you. So we went out there. Well, we became friends, and all through my navigation years and later on flying transports as a pilot, I would run into those guys.
Really?
At various places in the world, Japan, Germany, Spain, you name it. I would walk in. New Zealand aircraft sitting out there, so I almost could bet who I was going to run across. So sure enough, I did. And so we became really good friends. And that was typical. Later on, when I was 141 pilot, I got into Germany, and no matter what the base was, usually it was Ramstein, but or Rhein-Main at Frankfurt. You see a German pilot in uniform with American wings. So you'd walk up and say, "Where'd you go through pilot training?" And more often than not, it was Reese.
Oh.
And so, bang, you were taken care of for the evening. You know?
Connections.
Connections, yeah. Connections. Yeah. So, but it was kind of a good brotherhood, and the Germans really liked that camaraderie. Regressing again back into war story time, this retired major pilot that I knew at Dover when I first started flying there as a navigator. He forgot his name, but he's telling me this story about this young second lieutenant on a raid into Germany in a P-47, the Jug.
Okay.
And he just got the hell shot out of him. I mean, there were pieces missing off the airplane, a couple cylinders missing off the engine. He's pumping oil, and he's chugging on back to England. And this German in ME-109 came up, pulled up alongside him on the wing and looked over him at him and grinned and pulled on back and just hosed him from one wingtip to the other wingtip. And more parts flew, more oil flew. And the German was out of ammo. He expended every round he had on that P-47 and it was still chugging along. And the guy's curled up in his armor, because it had armor plating in that fighter. So the German pulls up on the wing again, shakes his head, salutes him, peels off and goes home. And I thought that was always a pretty good one. But that, you know, there was a camaraderie there, even between services. Let's see, where was I?
I was going to ask you a little bit about your training on the O2. What was that like? What did you think about the aircraft?
Well, it was the training. We had quite a group going through at that time, because there was a horrendous need for pilots in Vietnam, since it was limited to a one-year tour. We got out to this little field, and of course there was some academia, but it was a typical little remote field location, and we just stayed in our flight suits all the time. And so we had some academics. Most of the training courses I'd been through as a pilot were pretty well split up, half academics, half flying. And so we did our daytime flying, we did our nighttime flying. And one interesting comment that I want to make about it, the fact that I had done a lot of shooting of gun, all growing up and everything. And the O2 had a little heads-up display, not really a typical heads-up display. It was a typical gun sight, clear glass, and it had the compass rose on it, and then, of course, you'd had the pipper in the gun sight. And I remember toward the end, my instructor and I went out and on a training mission one night, and over there on Eglin, they had some simulated truck parks, you know, with old, you know, beat-up trucks simulating all this stuff. And I was supposed to meet up with this flight of A1 Sky Raiders from someplace. I forgot where they're coming from. Maybe Eglin. But anyway, typical, make contact, you know, establish the target area and mark the target and say, okay, go kill them. Okay. And talk about a golden BB moment. I rolled in, and of course the O2s had the what we call the Willy Pete's, the white phosphorus marking rockets. You've heard of those
before? Yes, sir.
And I rolled in, and I lined it up, and I pickled off a rocket. Damn if I didn't hit one of those trucks right square on. So we pulled off. That made my instructor stay. We pulled off and he called the set of fighters. He says, "Roger, target marked, you can have the other three." And those guys couldn't come close to the truck park, let alone hit any of the others. And they went home very mad. That was one of my more glorious moments in training for the O2. I thought that was pretty good.
Now, was this training at what they call FACU?
It probably was. That doesn't ring a bell, but it was probably FACU, yeah. Because, and I can't remember the name of the field. Have you heard that before? It was just west of Hurlburt.
Yeah.
It was a little auxiliary airfield out there.
I could find out for you. But
I can call Colonel Driscoll probably. He'd probably remember.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No.
At this time, you knew you were going to be going to Vietnam.
Oh, yes. That was a pipeline set up. I mean, you go through training and, you know, the next stop is an airliner and head west. So,
had any of your instructors at this point been to Vietnam?
Oh, yes.
So, would they instruct you on, this is how things are over there, this will help you get through it?
Yeah, the instruction on that was real good.
Okay.
All of those guys had been there, done that. And so, as you know, when you get somebody even in a college situation that has been there, lived real life and done something, as opposed to somebody got everything out of a book, the whole learning experience is so greatly enriched that you get a feel for it that you don't otherwise.
So you went to Vietnam in October 1968, is that when?
Yes.
Okay, and you started. First, you had another jungle survival school, is that?
Well, en route. Before
en route.
I actually got to Vietnam, we went to Clark Air
Base,
and we had all the academics there and got introduced to the surroundings, including the bamboo vipers. I don't know whether have you ever heard of those? Well, they're a little green, skinny snake about a couple of feet long. And they had some in glass cages there at the jungle survival school. And most of this was on Clark Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember they were mean little critters because nearly all of them would rise up in a striking poise and hood out like a cobra, and they would pound against that glass until they were bloody in the face trying to get you. They were mean, and nearly all of them were like that. And then they had this big boa. God, it was humongous. That snake was 20 feet long, and it was that big around. Humongous big thing. And they'd feed them three chickens every 3 days. You know, and snakes are like this, you know, almost like a cat, you know, a bird. You know, they just, once they know they got it, you know, they would, you know, this typical poise thing. But Jungle Survival School was really good. Those Negrito instructors there were really, they knew the jungle. And I got an experience to relate to you later on when I was assigned to Clark about that. But those Negritos were sharp, sharp people. And that's the reason MacArthur, there's a story about Lily Hill there on Clark Air Base. It was full of caves. And it's right in the middle of the base. And they were working on the runway in World War II. And snipers kept crawling out of their caves and shooting the guys working on the runway. And the Army couldn't do anything about it. And so finally, this Negrito chieftain came up. "We'll take care of it." And sure enough, they did. They went out, and in the next morning, they had drug them all out, dead. And at that time, it is reported, I don't know how true this is, but MacArthur grabbed the eagles off of that base commander and put them on that Negrito chieftain, and he still has them. Or he did at the time. I don't know whether he's still alive or not. But they had full commissary privileges, everything, after that.
Any particular incidents during Jungle Survival School?
No, other than the fact that, you know, I was able to hide from the Negritos. There weren't too many of us out of that class who were able to do that. Because, like I say, there's a lot of guys who weren't as young and healthy as I was at that time. You know, these older older officers that, you know, they'd been behind a desk and, you know, various things, and they weren't quite in as good a shape. But other than that, what I just related about some of the snakes and stuff, nothing really sticks in my... It was more or less of a gentleman's survival school. It wasn't the high pressure like we had at Stead. It was I think a combination of trying to teach you as much as they can, but doing it in such a way as to, you know, not make you feel ready to, you know, curl your toes and tuck your tail and crawl into a hole somewhere.
Now, did you ever run into any of these dangerous snakes or other wildlife during...
No, I didn't. Before I went over, though, there used to be a guy here in town who was a knife maker. His name was Joe Martin. I remembered at the time that most of my life I always carried a good knife, and I looked at the Air Force issue survival knife, which I've still got, and I thought, I didn't know what type of environment I would be getting into. Mm-hmm. If I would crash land an airplane and have to carve my way out of it. So I went to Joe with this premise, you know, Joe, and I laid out the parameters, what might, could possibly happen. And he thought about it, and he designed me a knife and made it out of, at that time, the premier steel, which was used a lot in the shafts of submersible pumps. It was called 440 stainless steel. And it had a very strong characteristics of good edge holding, and you could run a car over it on a curve and it wouldn't break, and it had a lot of good features about it. So he built me this knife, and I've still got it also. And that's the one I carried to Vietnam. But I had that in the jungle survival school, and I'm surprised I made it through. I thought those Negritos were going to, you know, reapportion it. But when I got there, and of course I was issued a AR-15, which was a collapsible version of the had a short stock and a shorter barrel for use in an aircraft, and so I carried that. And they issued me a 38 revolver, which I wasn't too crazy about, so I had to bribed the guy on the flight line to, you know, trade that for a 45 government model. So.
And you carried this with you at all?
You bet. And I never turned it in a lot, especially during the Tet of 69 when I was there, because I kept all that stuff right with me, because they had a habit of crawling over the fences and coming on base, and I didn't want to be sitting there wishing I had my weapon.
That's right.
But in that case, I never had to use it.
I just wanted to back up. How did your wife feel about going to Vietnam? Your parents?
Well, it was, typical, you know, remorse, sadness. When I climbed on TWA there at Amarillo, headed west, it was, pretty grieving for her. But then she came back down here and got an apartment, and her sister and brother-in-law were living here with their three kids at that time. And so she had company here in town, and her old roommate from college was here in town. She's married to a rather prominent lawyer here in town. And so she had friends here, and so she just spent the time buried in work, finishing her master's. So.
And you arrived in Vietnam October 19th?
Yeah, it was either late October, 1st November.
At Benoit, or did you fly into
Actually, Clark, then I went to Saigon, and then I got shipped on up to Da Nang. And I was at Da Nang for a little while, and then they reassigned me back down to Benoit. So,
what were your first impressions? I know you had been to Vietnam before. Did you? What was the contrast between what you saw back in the early 60s?
Well,
those two?
It was just more of the same. I'd been there, like I say, I hadn't slept there, but, you know, I got to thinking, well, now I get to sleep here for a year. And Saigon wasn't quite as prone to this as what Benoit was, but Benoit was kind of known as Rocket City, and they had a corner in the Dongnai River they used to come down and set up their rocket launchers and launch at Benoit. And Sparta, this little army helicopter base just southeast of us. There were a lot of nights we had to run from the bunkers. And,
what was your typical day like? I know you flew at exclusively
night.
At night.
Yes.
So could you take me?
Well, most of the time, while we were there, I tried to get some exercise while I was there. And when I first got there, I ran across a guy I had flown with in Dover. He was in ranch hand. Okay. And ranch hand guys, their hooches were right close to ours. They were in, we were all clustered in the back of the officers' club. Rich something. His last name was Richardson, and I can't remember his first name at the moment. But anyway, he was there, and he was a jogger. And so he started dragging me out once we had discovered each other in the club. And so I was still right after that ejection. And when I went out, I not only compressed three vertebrae, but on the inner edges, like balsa wood, but I had a severe muscle trauma also. So when I start jogging, oh Lord. It hurt. But the more I jogged, the less it hurt. And within about a month and a half, 2 months, I could warm up, go jog, and it wouldn't hurt. Mm-hmm. So I knew I was doing a good thing. Mm-hmm. So I continued jogging quite a lot after that. But anyway, Rich had to get up. I think they usually took off about 3 in the morning. And then they had dropped their load right at first light. And then they'd get on back to Benoit. So we'd meet sometime during the day. Now normally, we would take off after sundown till just before sunrise. And then I'd come back and we'd either have a party in the club, and that was kind of unusual because what we did on those slides when I show you, we got in these blue pajamas, light blue pajamas out of the BX and had our rank and wings and everything all sewn on them, so in patches. So we would be partying by the time these guys were staggering out of bed into the club for breakfast. So, but normally, just go to bed, sleep till about mid-afternoon, go out and catch a few rays, mm-hmm. and go jog or eat, mm-hmm. and start the briefings for the night mission and so on.
And you flew mostly, was it 3-corps? The area,
yeah,
and what your missions, okay. And what were your missions exactly? Was it to
our mission mainly was to orbit Saigon and continually watch for incoming rockets. Okay. We were mainly a Saigon cap. Any time, however, having this availability of being airborne all night, because we normally flew 2 to 3 hour missions. And before we left the station, another guy had come up and take the station.
Okay.
That was all good in theory, but we got called on a lot when things started happening. Other nights, we had missions of just recon. And our situation was we were sleepy time packs, and we carried a navigator. And the navigator would open the window and hook it to the wing, and he would be leaning out with a starlight scope.
Okay.
And we'd be looking for little lights in the jungle and trees and stuff like that. When I went over there, I was having, my skin was breaking out, probably from the stress and tension, but my wife put me on some of this vitamin A, this water-soluble vitamin A. So I was taking that, and that combined with sleeping in the daytime, flying at night,
mm-hmm.
my eyesight got unbelievable. And I could tell it was getting better because we get a new kid in the right seat.
and I'd be out instructing him, you know, showing him the different areas, mm-hmm. and showing him little clusters of lights and so on down in the jungle, and showing the curve of the river. I don't see it. Even on a moonless night, mm-hmm. just starlight strictly, you know, I could see the reflections of the river and the woods and so on in the jungle, and they couldn't make it out. And then I told the flight surgeons about it when I came back, and they wrote a few things down about it. I don't know, just the fact that yeah. this guy reported that, mm-hmm. you know, and documented it. But we'd take them out, and I was just so amazed at how well I could see with the time. Now, I'm still pretty fortunate, even at age 60, I'm farsighted, okay. and I have to have glasses to read now. If I hold it out far enough, and if the print's big enough, I can do it yeah. without that, but I've been real fortunate for eyesight. Mm-hmm. Let's see, am I getting to answering your question?
Yes.
another things are coming to my mind here rather frequently. Most of our missions, week-wide and pre-flight the aircraft, one airplane, the condition of the airplanes was interesting. A couple of those aircraft have been there for a long time. And the O2 was really the Cessna 335 Skymaster twin engine. It was a push-pull situation with a twin boom tail. A lot of those guys flying them didn't use too much discretion on the airframe. Now, remember, this was a civilian airframe that was gotten off the assembly line, loaded with radios and little deals along the wings to hang rockets on and stuff. But the airframe itself wasn't really built, I didn't think, to handle the, you know, the G-forces of pulling out after marking a target and stuff like that. A couple of them were bent. And there was one airplane, and I'll never forget that this was Jim Thorpe, was it? All-American. It was his great-grandson, I think. Was a crew chief on this airplane. And that damn airplane, the problem with it, if you lost your front engine, the rear engine was near center line of the aircraft, mm-hmm. so you could fly it without too much trouble. But if you lost your rear engine, then you're dragging this whole airframe through the air. And this one aircraft was bent so bad that I never tried this, but I felt like it wouldn't go past 95 knots straight down full power. And I often thought, God, if I ever lost my rear engine in that airplane, I had gone out on a day mission one day and just looked for places to mm-hmm. crash land because I knew it wasn't going to fly. And there, of course, the Dong Nai River was out there going west from the base of the runway. And so I had to had earlier picked up the landmarks in this nice sandy little beach yeah. on there. That's going to have to put it. And out east, that was less than desirable. But we mainly took off to the west on that runway at Benoit. Sometimes to the east, but it was kind of rare. But then just before I came back, we got a couple of new airplanes, and God, they were practically flew themselves. You know, they were just so straight and level, and the endurance was far superior to the old ones, and it was just really great. You could fly 3.5 hours in one of those new ones, when in the old ones, you know, you'd go not even near 3 hours. It was just really wild. But mm-hmm. being aerodynamically dirty, they didn't fly as well, mm-hmm. and so they consumed more fuel.
Were there weapons on the O2s?
Well,
I know you mentioned the
only rocket. What we carried personally, and then the White Phosphorus marking rockets, and then we also carried these Navy log flares. They were direct out of the Navy parts then, and they were the best I could tell. They were a B
big white phosphorus device inside of a solid log of hardwood. And you could drop them and they would stay lit for quite a while, whereas the Willie Pete's would, you know, soon fizzle and die. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was mainly, and you couldn't put it out on the ground. There was no way. I mean, the white phosphorus just burned with such intensity that, you know, I mean, everything around it caught on fire. And I've started quite a few good jungle fires mm-hmm. with this thing.
What altitude did you typically fly out in?
Normally we flew at about 1,200 feet. We didn't get down too low at night because we didn't want to run into any of the Army helicopters, which very often ran blacked out. We would support these guys and maintain a cap on them. That they had an operation, I don't know what they called it, but they would have three helicopters, one of them with a big old searchlight on it, and they would be down there looking at the bullfrogs in the eyeballs. Those kids, they were past 19, they got too much sense, you know, to do what they did. But they had the guy with the light, the guy right above him, a gunship orbiting him, and then they had a command ship at the third level. And then I would usually mess around with those guys up above them. And if I could spot something, being higher, I could usually spot it. And I really don't recall anything of incidents happening there. Occasionally, we went down below in the Delta area, south of Saigon, into that area was more or less known as Four Corps. And sometimes some of those Navy patrol boats or river boats would run into a lot of fire. And they would relay to 3-DASC, and 3-DASC would get a hold of us, and we'd go scooting on south. Mainly, when we found a firefight going on, or when we marked a target, it was usually put in a set of fighters, and we were working a lot with the 100s out of Benoit. We had a squadron or two of 100s. And we had some A-37s there, but I didn't work with them until just at the very end. The real good people, we adjusted artillery. We worked with artillery quite a lot. But the guys that really got the job done were the Spookies. Those Spooky guys, they had a commander at that time, Ducky Rowe. He was a former aircraft commander out of KC-135's old sack tanker pilot. But he had an attitude. Oh God, he was so good. And every pilot in that outfit, every crew member of that outfit just shared his attitude. By God, if there's a fight going on anywhere, they want a piece of it. And they would go get a piece of it and usually stop it. It got so that the Viet Cong and Charlie would just really, they had captured radios, and whenever Spooky was 5 minutes out, they would break contact nearly every time and disappear. I got a story about that too. One night, there's Spooky and I, and we're orbiting around Saigon area. Nothing's going on. All of a sudden, 3-DASC calls us, and this was about 2 a.m. And there was a little fire support base up near the Cambodian border that was under heavy attack. Now Spooky, the C-47, mm-hmm. was a lot faster than the O-2. So we both rolled out balls to the wall and went sailing that direction. You know, he got there first, and 5 minutes out, sure enough, just like clockwork, they broke contact. So I got there. And I was talking to this lieutenant on the ground who was in charge of this fire support base. So we orbited and orbited, and nothing happened. So I went down and I got directions from this kid as to where he thought they might be. So I went down and I went low altitude, low and slow, trolling. And didn't catch around, not one bullet fired. Then started coming light, and we were both running on fuel, low on fuel. And so we
made contact with the guy. We'd been in contact with him all this time, talking with him. But we told him we're getting bingo fuel, we're going to have to beat it on back to the base. And he said, and Spooky had a full load of 17,500 rounds aboard. He hadn't expended a bullet all night. So this kid asked him to hose down his tree line about a click or two away from the support base. Hose that sucker. He expended every round on that tree line. And I'm not sure if you understand the consequence of this, but one just few second burst out of those 3 gallons in that Goonie Bird would put a bullet every square foot on average of the size of a football field. So he expended all his load on that tree line, and there was nothing left but toothpicks. So to get, somebody from the Spooky outfit called me one day, and they were on the other side of the base from us. They were on the east, southeast corner. We were on the southwest corner. And so I borrowed the unit Jeep and went on over there. And this kid that we had talked to brought down this shot to crap AK-47. And he said, this was the best one. We had 250 bodies lying out there. A lot of people. But that Goonie Bird, that Spooky, and the attitude of that commander really made a difference down there in 3 Corps and 4 Corps, wherever that they went. I mean, they were very
effective.
Deadly,
yeah.
Very effective. But the attitude was good. You know, they wanted in on it. One of the guys said, you know, the attitude put forth in a unit by a commander makes such a difference. One of my our guys, he was out in eastern edges, as I recall. It's all getting pretty fuzzy, but they had marked a target, and they were working with a flight of F-4s out of Cameron, and those guys couldn't get anywhere close to the target. So they went home, and he came on back and wrote it up and reported it that they couldn't really hit a bull in the ass with a base of them. And they got in pretty much in trouble over that, and they had to go back and requalify bomb drop procedure and so on. But I didn't have any trouble. The 100 guys at Benoit, they usually put it on the money. You mark the target, and that's where that bomb. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any problem at all about hitting the mark. And of course, Spooky. Oh Lord, those guys. They were dead.
You mentioned AAA fire. How often would you receive fire?
Well, now, you got to make a distinction here.
Okay.
What I ran into down in 3 Corps was small arms fire.
Small arms fire,
yeah.
Okay.
And I'm talking about machine gun or
okay.
less.
Okay.
At that time, they didn't have any AAA. That was all up near the DMZ.
Okay.
So we never had any problem like that. Now, it was many times I rolled in mark a target, and they knew they had been discovered, and just a wall of bullets would come at us.
Okay.
The O2 was good in the respect that you could, since it had two engines, you could turn your lights out and put the props out of sync.
Mm-hmm.
They go wah wah, wah, and they couldn't tell where you were.
Oh, okay.
And they just roll off into a whiffle or two, and you'd see them firing in some other area, but they couldn't pinpoint you
okay.
by sound.
Okay.
That point.
How well was the plane, the aircraft fortified?
It wasn't.
It wasn't.
It was all thin aluminum.
Okay. Okay. And you mentioned working with Navy patrol boats.
Yeah, this didn't happen very often,
okay.
but every now and then, if the timing was right, when a patrol boat got under fire down on a river
mm-hmm.
somewhere, and they needed help right away. So, you know, it's just one of those that whoever's closest to the action like a cop around town, you know, whoever's closest goes to the put the fire out, and so we get down there and at the same time try and get spooky or or call for a set of fires and moonshine. Now, moonshine was another C-47.
Okay.
That would orbit and throw out flares to mark the target area. So we could see what we were doing. Okay. You know, parachute flares.
Okay.
And you'd try to set something up en route before you even knew what you were going to be doing. But normally those Navy patrol boats, you know, they would lay little traps for them and they'd try and just blast them out of the water. And but they go on the radio pretty damn quick, and usually one of us reacted quite a lot to that. And when we get to the point, I'll tell you about my last night, my last mission. And but we're a little bit premature yet on that. So anyway, the daily routine went pretty much as I said. I can't think of much else. We all look forward to R&R. Of course, we the few nights we had off, we would go over to the officers' club and sit around and drink and have a. We didn't. It was rather interesting. Some of the guys in my outfit had been very, you know, non-drinking types, and they went over and became sots. And then some of the others that had consumed a little too much before went over and dried out. You know, it was just kind of weird the way that happened. And a couple of the younger guys tend to do it quite a lot. And even on my night off, I'd go fly for them. You know, the navigator would come and get me and and let's go fly. So I think I got somewhere around the vicinity of 800 hours that year flying.
You mentioned R&R. Did you take any?
Oh, I sure did. Yeah. My navigator. I flew with quite a few different navigators, but one that I flew with the most, his name was Dave Woolsey, and Dave was really sharp. In the months that we flew together, I taught him how to fly, and of course, this was an insurance policy for me. He got to the point where he could take off and land the thing, but we flew with different people. One night in particular, I was up, and that's where this comes in. I got this Distinguished Flying Cross. I was up near Song Bay in a Special Forces camp, and this is Dave right here. But he wasn't with me the night I got this. A navigator by the name of Doc Holliday. He was James H. Halliday was the way he spelled it. We called him Doc. And he was a major, and I was still a captain at that time. But we went up there, and this little work team. Never quite distinguished whether it's an alert team or just a little special forces team. Uh-huh. At night was under attack, and I took off from Benoit knowing I was going up there that night. So I checked with the weatherman. It was really god awful weather. I mean, thunderstorms is monsoon season, and this weatherman, I really got him by the throat the next day. But he said the thunderstorms were dissipating. So I went up there, and I was with a shadow gunship. Now, they were the 119, $1.19 gunships. And they were out of, I forgot where they were out of. It might have been Benoit, but we really hadn't had that good of communication with them. So we went up there, and I went flying low and slow in the area that was indicated to us back at Benoit. And so I got the frequency, and I started talking, and it was a while before I heard the whisper. He was whispering, because they were so close. So we set up a deal to go ahead and have them move from their present position and then somehow give me a mark. So he gave me a coded
flashlight, mm-hmm. hooded flashlight mark. And so he said, they're just to the north of us. And so I went in and rolled in a Willoughby, and in shadow hose the area down. And by that time, the weather had gone to crap. And in order to get back, I'd have had to fly IFR in that little airplane, which I wasn't crazy about, instrument flight ones. And it was down low level over war zone D, which was not a healthy place to fly low over. So I elected, since I was short on fuel, that I was going to land at Song Bay. Now, Song Bay had two strips, and when I show you the slides, I'll show you the difference. They had a little city strip, which was the main street of town that the mm-hmm. O-1 guys mm-hmm. used that were based there. And then the Army had a little 4,000-foot pierced steel plate PSP strip over on the northwest side of Nui Barat, which was the mountain right there. So I got the frequency, and I called this kid that more or less maintained the airfield there, the Army strip at Song Bay. And they didn't have any lights. It was a 400-foot ceiling. And I was heading on over there, and I was flying instruments, because we were, even at that low level, we were in turbulence, we were in IFR conditions, but I knew which way to go. So I was flying that direction, and I'll never forget, old Doc was over there. He had vertigo. He didn't know whether he was sitting on his head or his tail. So we broke out in the clear, and he got reoriented, and I went over there and contacted this young enlisted guy, Army enlisted guy, and I told him the situation. I was going to have to land. And so, monsoon season, they were expecting major attack by the large, I don't know what size, battalion size or something that you see up in that area. But couldn't go anywhere else, so I had to land. So he drove the runway in his Jeep. So I saw where it was, and they put a mortar flare into the clouds, which just made it hard. So I said, cease mortar fire. And so I went on downwind, and he was getting close to the runway, at the end of the runway. And so I turned and went ahead and made a nice short, tight pattern, and I aimed right for his damn Jeep. And right as I got about 50 feet, I flipped my landing lights on, and he had gone off the end of that PSP into his barge, which is and I could see him leaping because he thought I was going to hit him. And PSP runway, very washboard.
Yeah.
And I set it down, brought the throttle style, stood on the brakes, and the rear engine quit when I brought it back. So I knew there was no go around, so we were kind of skating along. And so he drags himself out of that bar ditch. So he comes up in front of us and motions, come on. So, you know, I still got the front engine going, so we pull up to the corner of the compound on this. It's PSP, but there's mud on it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a grody mm-hmm. area. And we shut it down, grabbed our guns and our gear, and I threw a couple of rocks under the wheels. Closed up as best I could, because they're expecting a hellacious rainstorm. Mm-hmm. And we jumped in a Jeep with him, and I... That poor guy. So anyway, they take us into the camp and in behind the barbed wire, and we had parked the airplane right under this big quad 50 they had mounted on the corner of the compound. And we went in, and they took us to the VIP bunker. And it was
mostly submerged and lined with logs, mm-hmm. and it was all that red dirt. Mm-hmm. And so we got down there, it's kind of late at night, you know, and I'm tired. And Doc is too, so we hang our weapons on nails out of logs or something. And it started raining. You had never seen it rain like it has rained during monsoons in Vietnam. It came down in buckets. And pretty soon, the water started rising. We're on these little old GI cots. And old Doc looked over at me and he says, "Gary, what in the hell are we doing here?" And I said, I forget what my comment was, but it was something appropriate at the time. And I said, "Reckon we're going to get our trousers dirty tonight." And then when they let us off, before we went into the bunker, they pointed out a machine gun right on the edge. And they said, "Well, we're a little short of people, so if we do come under attack, how about coming out and manning this thing for us?" Okay. So it rained and it rained, and sure enough, it got to about a half inch or so below the bottom of the cot. Now, we stayed in dressed, you know, we mm-hmm. didn't, except for hanging the weapon up. And I slept with my 45 in hand. Mm-hmm. But anyway, next morning it was pretty well cleared up, and most of the rain in that area, you know, such a saturation of mm-hmm. atmospheric moisture, it built up in the afternoon heat, and then during the night it would tend to fizzle mm-hmm. away. So it wasn't really clear. There's still haze in the mm-hmm. air, but when we got up and we went down to the mess tent and had some of their breakfast, and because I was starving, and so Doc and I threshed on back, and this kid met us again and took us back out to the airplane, and we did a very careful pre-flight. We didn't want to make sure no booby traps or anything. So
the engine was okay. You mentioned that it
yeah,
cut out
it,
right when
it had just been a setting. It was a fuel injected engine, see, and they had a little disc, and it just wasn't adjusted quite right. So when I brought it back quickly, why, it shut the fuel off completely to that engine and installed, whereas it has a little device that's adjustable to bring it back to an idle position, but not cut the fuel off entirely. So cranked it up, and you know, the airplane was coated with red mud. We were coated with red mud. And we flew on back to Benoit, and then I saw why I like flying at night better, because it was early in the morning. It was about 7 o'clock, and of course I had our controlling agency, you know, go ahead and contact the unit, tell them I'm landing at Song Bay. And so we walked in, everybody's up. We walk in the door, nobody says a word. You know, just look, and Doc and I walk in, and we're a mess. You know, we landed and taxied into the refuel area, and the crew chief came out. "Where the hell were you guys flying?" He hadn't heard, you know, he wasn't in the communication room. You know, and he looked at his airplane, and it's covered with red mud. And so we got in the Jeep and went on back up to the hooch, and walked in. Like I said, nobody saying anything. And our boss at that time was a Major Greenleaf, and he says, "A lot of calls about you guys last night from MACB down and headquarters down in Saigon." And well, and Doc was back there shaking it to everything I said. You know, I said, my ass was in a crack, you know, so I had to do what I felt like the safest thing to do. And I didn't want to fly down over War Zone D at, you know, 200 or 300 feet and get shot at by every, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry that happened to be wandering around with nothing better to do. So I landed, and so I got the airplane back on. It was a little dirty, but you know, we're back and we're all right. And so, you know, wisdom took the better part of valor there, and he thought, well, that would have been a hell of a lot of paperwork, you know, had you dinged in. So I was let off the hook there, you know, but did the safe thing. And that's where the DSC came from that night. Not so much for the landing. That looked pretty good on the OER, but officer effectiveness report.
Okay.
You're getting pretty savvy about this.
I'm learning.
But it was helping out that team that we went to support. So, anyway. Never came to mind, but if you like, we can set up for another time.
Okay.
If you like.
This is Kim Sawyer continuing an interview with Frank G. Stone III on March 30th, 2001. We are in the Special Collections Library at Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Stone has brought some slides to show.
As you can see, there's an awful lot of traffic. This is a slide of near the Kowloon Ferry, or the Star Ferry, in use today. A picture of the harbor showing a junk, and these are normally all over the place, but even at that time in the late 60s, you can see the skyline is rather humongous, and the large ads were all over the place. Rolex and various other well-established worldwide companies were there. And again, another junk. This is looking at Hong Kong Island. And at that sharp peak in the middle is Victoria Peak. And Hong Kong's a very interesting place. You find that you might get 6 hours of sleep the first night, and it dwindles from there until you finally leave. And then you sleep on the airplane going back wherever you're going to.
Now, this was an R&R trip?
This was a leave trip.
Okay.
I was very fortunate. As I mentioned in the earlier interview, I was actually attached to the unit in Da Nang. And they kept all my paperwork, but I was actually assigned down at Benoit in the sleepy time office. And I had to submit through channels to get this leave, and my navigator and I went up there. And we got up there, and lo and behold, after this leave was over, then they had lost the papers. So really, the leave was strictly basket only. And later went to R&R in Hawaii to meet my wife, and then also later on, I took another trip to Hong Kong. So I had the enjoyment of two trips up there. Hong Kong is a fascinating place. It's one of the most fascinating places on the face of this earth because it's so multicultural up there. It's primarily, of course, Chinese, but at that time there were just so many Europeans and you name it, they were there. And junk traveling in the harbor, and again, all the buildings over there in Hong Kong Island. I think they may sell real estate there by the grain of sand. It's just so expensive. Ships from all over the world are usually at harbor in there. Later on, when I was assigned to the Philippines, my wife and I managed to take a little trip up to Hong Kong from Clark, and the Officers' Wives Club there at Clark had set it up, and it was a Danish tour company, and they were flying some old Comets. And anyway, we went up there, and we had from the base, the General's aide, General Manor, was in command down there, 13th Air Force. And Melisai was his name, American Chinese. And so we all went up there, and we had such a time. But what I'm getting to is that the hotel where we stayed had this penthouse bar, and we went up there at night and overlooked the harbor with all the lights, and it was just spectacular. Okay, there's the ferry, and I think the slide is in backwards because all the steering wheels are on the right-hand side of the car. They were typical British there, and I don't know whether they've switched back since they've gone into Chinese control or not. I would imagine they are leading to that. And that's yours truly, back when I was about 29. But my nav, Dave Woolsey, took this slide. And that's Dave on the right. And the guy in the middle is his nephew. He was in the Army, enlisted out of Okinawa. And David communicated with him. And that slide's in backwards too. You can see the Rolex. But we had quite a time together, and he hadn't seen this kid in quite a while. So it was a good trip. Typical Hong Kong street, see the British double-decker buses, and Hong Kong is just fabulous. If there's any kind of food, just anything at all you can imagine on the face of this earth, you'll find it in Hong Kong. This is a typical narrow street. We're in a cab, of course, and the driver's on the right. And it was just so interesting going around and seeing all these things. I got quite a few of these pictures. This alleyway and this stairway appeared in quite a few of the movies filmed in Hong Kong. And I remember Chuck Norris's movie, and I remember this alley from several movies, or that stairwell. And everything's for sale, and it's usually in open air vendors out in the streets, and that's one of them. And you'll notice how the apartments, you'll have families living in one or two rooms, and usually large families, and hanging the clothes out the balcony to dry. The shops in Hong Kong, at least at the time I was there, they are normally very deep and very narrow, and they will have stuff to the ceiling. And let me see, one other, there's a later slide here that I'll get into another discussion, but this old lady's building obviously a stove, and she's a food vendor, so she's pounding out the remains of an old 5-gallon can that the Navy used to ship coffee in aboard ship, so she somehow scrounged it. And there's just some jewelry and various paraphernalia. And a view of the tenements there. That God, it just must be unbelievably crowded. There's what I'm talking about. I went into a shop such as this. Is that a reflection on you? Can you see it?
Okay? I can see it. Yeah.
Okay. In one of these shops, where all the carvings and the various little statuettes and so on, I found what was there was a long elephant tusk, and it had been carved, and it was started when this kid, the man that did it, was a young man, probably in his early teens. And he continued this through his life. I wish I'd have gotten a picture of it. But you can see it was a carving resembling an early Chinese riverboat. And with all the cabins and everything, and you could see where he started, he was not as good as when in his middle years. He got very precise and then kept on, and toward the end of his work on this was quite good. It was very precise and very tediously made. I mean, all the little windows, everything. And what really shocked me was this represented this man's life's work. It was for sale for $3,000. Now, $3,000 at that time would be considerably more now, but I was just appalled at a man's life's work could be on sale there for $3,000. Because at that time, you could buy a fancy new car for $3,000. And more vendors, this one, food vendor. Most of them, well, a lot of them are food vendors. They just had their soup and everything. Again, the crowded way, barbers, everything for sale, fruits, vegetables.
and you usually smell the butcher shop long before you get to it. But I think most of the meat and everything in Hong Kong was very fresh. You didn't have any problem. Well, I won't say not any problem, but you had to be rather careful with what you ate and where you were eating. Now, that represents a tenement, and I got another picture of it here in a second, but the families live in one or two rooms of these things, hang their laundry out over the balcony, and their school for that tenement is on top of the building. And another interesting sidelight, later on when I was at Flying 141s after my assignment in Vietnam, I was going to be diverted to Hong Kong one night for a medical pickup. Well, they were telling me I might have to use the backfield approach. Now the runway goes out into the ocean at that time. They built a new one since then, but it goes out into the ocean and goes inland, straight into the mountains. And so the backfield approach consisted of a big old checkerboard painted high on a mountain, and you leave, there's an island down south of Hong Kong called Stonecutters, and they had a radio beacon there. So what the procedure was, to fly to Stonecutters, do figure eights while you're descending to a certain altitude, I forget what it was, and then depart Stonecutters Beacon, head for the checkerboard painted on the mountain, fly as close as you dare at a certain altitude, very low, do a hard right with full flaps, gear, everything ready to land, but there's a caution in the approach plate that I remember, watch out for the tops of the apartment buildings. Luckily, they didn't. Somebody else picked the guy up, and it wasn't a backfield approach. It was in off the water, so that was fine. But it made going around from that situation somewhat of a hellacious situation. We took a tour on a bus, and of course, everybody's selling tours, like I said, selling everything. But anywhere you look over the water, there's usually junk tramp freighters from you name it. They're there. And this is approaching Aberdeen, and I apologize for the slide, but as I said, I developed these myself at Benoit, so my technique was not the very finest. This is one of the very few places around that area where they actually have a beach and people swim. But it's approaching Aberdeen, and they've got a lot of very famous floating restaurants there in Aberdeen. And this is Aberdeen, more junks. People spend their lives on those things. It's just unbelievable to me. There's one of the floating restaurants. Some years ago, I think 8 or 10 years ago, one of them blew up and burned. But there were 4 or 5 as I recall. But you'll notice the junks all around. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll go out fishing, bring it back, sell it. But in back of that floating restaurant, they had a Taipak, I guess is the name of it there. They had a big submerged pen, and they had all kinds of fish, and they'd raise the bottom to bring them all near the surface so you could pick out what you wanted to eat. They would catch it, clean it, cook it, mm-hmm. and it's about as fresh as you could get. However, that water around there, didn't look all that trustworthy. And there I am again. I'm really apologetic about these slides, the quality of them, you know, they're just, but they're in wartime conditions, so. As we approached the new territories, as they call them, up near the Chinese border, there's this little town, and it was built almost from a medieval standpoint, with a moat all the way around it and everything. Very interesting, but it was a totally walled, small city inside. And the alleyways, as you can see, there were no vehicles inside whatsoever. And there were a lot of people touring. And one of the neat things about this was all you saw, as far as residents went, were the little children and old, old people. All the middle-aged working group departed every day to go seek a job somewhere. But this was typical of, and these are, I think, all people off the tour, mm-hmm. GIs and R&R up there. looking out toward the new territories, I've got a better slide, but people, any kind of structure at all, built out of cardboard, you name it, they were living in it. And those are all rice paddies, and I think I mentioned earlier the smell. It wasn't quite as bad in Hong Kong as it was in Vietnam, but that's looking out, and at that time, of course, that was China out in the distance, and they were communist, and the border definitely existed. The British were in control of Hong Kong, so that was kind of no man's land out there in the middle. This is on one of the few hills around the area where we were, and there's a hotel on top there. I've got a slide of that. There's the hotel up there. It's just beautiful. And then they had the people in the traditional garb running around, you know, wanting you to take their picture for a fee. So I just grabbed a couple of shots from a distance. And a lot of Australians were in Hong Kong. They traveled to up there quite a lot. And even those little junks, and people were born on them, lived on them, died on them. And it just amazed me but they would spend their entire lives on these things. We're continuing the tour. Actually, the quality of the slides isn't as bad as I thought. The colors are not faded too bad. I, of course, keep them in the dark. But everywhere you look, there's the junks, and the British did an awful lot for Hong Kong. They were building water reservoirs and hospitals and one thing and another. And I really had to give, my hat was really off to them because they did such a fine job. And road improvements, and they really tried to take care of everybody. And one interesting thing I noticed, I never saw anybody with a scowl on their face. They were all happy. There was food, there was employment, there was just everything they needed. And so they had quite an incursion problem from the communist side, coming in on junks, and of course, trying to control that must have been a nightmare from a logistical standpoint. And there's, I think, a new hospital they built, and they were just doing an awful lot in the area to improve life for them. There's another floating restaurant. Just different scenic shots, but you'll see the shacks down there people were living in. There's the balcony of that hotel. It was really nice. We went in, had a cup of coffee and a little snack, and Dave and I, we spent that day just really having a lot of fun. We had a beer, and it was a good long grau straight from Germany, non-pasteurized, and it was fabulous. Now that's kind of a bleached out slide, but you'll notice a couple of story tenements down there where most of those people, the Shatin Heights, yeah, I'd forgotten that. That's a little British gal there. We talked to her a little while, but Dave and I were just putzing around the hotel while the bus was there. And we're getting on back into Kowloon, and we stopped at some kind of stop on top of the hill and looked down, and that city, even at that time, was so crowded. It's just unbelievable. And some of these slides are a little bit mixed up, but I think I might have been out back of where we were earlier in that high up shot. Okay, now we'll start the Vietnam shots. This one, you'll notice there's a Huey, yeah, and it's carrying a little Loach helicopter that had been shot down. Now, a couple of things about this is, first off, you'll notice there's very little vegetation. And you'll see the bomb craters all around the place there. So there was an awful lot of activity. Even now, we weren't very far from Saigon at this time. But as I mentioned earlier, this guy that I was friendly with, his name was Dale, he worked over in 3DASC, which was the Air Quarter Controlling Agency for 3 Corps. Or one of them. But Dale and I were friendly, and he was checked out in the 01, and so he borrowed an airplane one day, and we just went around, and I was sitting in the back, and neat thing about the 01 was from the back seat, you could fold up the windows, hook them to the wing, and you had this beautiful view out both sides. So I was back there with my camera just going nuts. So I hadn't seen most of this country. Now, this is a little village, not too far from Saigon, but it's in the middle of a rubber plantation. And it's hard to tell in a village like that what type of hat they wear at night. Could be there's Viet Cong sympathizers, or they might have been friendly, I don't know. But you can see how thick all the those rubber trees are. And that is the Dong Nai River, and we're just northeast of Ben Hoa at that juncture. And they used to float down the river at night on their sampans and set up little rocket launch positions in that area and fire them at Ben Hoa, because Ben Hoa, while I was there, was known as Rocket City. And remember I told you earlier about the white phosphorus marking rockets? Well, that was similar. There were a pod of four there.
Okay.
And we carried those on both wings of the 02 as he did on the 01. We landed at various little bases, and these two aircraft here are the OV-10s, and they thought they would use those particular aircraft as FAC aircraft, but they had a difficult time at night, and they used them much over the trails, you know, the high traffic areas. But they had a problem with it because they had the canopy reflected. It was a more or less a bubble canopy, and all the instrument lights would reflect off of it at night, and so you really couldn't see very well. But then there's Air America right there, little tail dragger, and a chopper and a revetment. But we used to catch rides with Air America a lot. I'd flown in that particular type of airplane. It was an old Grumman, I think, twin engine. And the Air Force used to use one similar to that for in pilot training for multi-engine purposes. But that was a newer airplane than what the Air Force had. But they were everywhere. Air America was everywhere. And there is a result of several results. You can see the Agent Orange had killed the vegetation, the upper level of the triple canopy jungle. You can also see the result of an arc light. So there was a squadron of B-52s, and that's the length of a bomb load right there. Or it could be one airplane and another airplane following close behind, but it was just truly devastating. And as I mentioned earlier, there at Ben Hoa, we would, in the officers' club, some of these young lieutenants would come out of the jungle, and they were just filthy dirty, and we'd let them use our shower and a bunk, you know, with clean sheets, and they hadn't seen that probably since Lord knows when. But they would say, you know, every now and then they get to take a bath in a bomb crater, and it didn't really appeal to me too much. Vietnam is a beautiful, beautiful country. I'm sorry this slide is a little bit washed out, but sometimes they just don't take the heat from the projector as well. But there's waterfalls and rivers and jungle, and even though that had probably been hit with Agent Orange, it grew back. It seems like it grew back rapidly, because some of the top layers of the triple canopy there, as you can see, are dead or either dying. But it was just so thick. It's unbelievable how thick that was. Now, that mountain in the distance is, I think that is Nui Ba Dinh. And it's located, there are two mountains, one out by the Cambodian border, and I think that was Nui Ba Ra. This one was Nui Ba Dinh, and it's right by Song Bay. And we're flying closer to it, and you'll see slides of it. But we are north of Nui Ba Dinh at this time. And Song Bay, the army strip is going to be over here, and the city strip is going to be in here. You'll see that in a second. Getting closer, you can see we're just piddling around there.
But you can see the city strip in the distance. We're northeast of the mountain at that time. And just like I say, I like a couple of tourists. Again, the thick jungle, that's a little bit better slide from a color standpoint. And we're getting closer. Of course, they hit all the area around Song Bay there with Agent Orange and pretty well killed the vegetation. That beautiful waterfall, it's just so, it's just such a shame. It would be a tourist mecca in the Central Highlands there if they could promote it. All the beautiful rivers and everything. Okay, there's Song Bay, the village. And they made the main a little city strip, and that's where we're about to land. Then over there where I got my DFC, it was over there, over here on the other side, that night that I got it. But the Army had the encampment on the northwest side of the mountain there, and the city was northeast. And you can see the nude landscape there is just pretty well defoliated completely. Of course, they had to. In the Central Highlands, it was so thick. And of course, the Montagnard tribesmen were up there, and you'll see more of them here in a minute. But we landed. There were a couple of facts that we knew, flying O-1s that were based there. And so we landed, and they kind of gave us a grand tour. I had this lens. It was Japanese made, but it wasn't quite as good as a Russian made. But it was a big mirror lens, 500 millimeter, and I don't know whether I didn't focus it quite right or whether later examples indicate that the lens might have been slightly off, but I sold it anyway. So these are Montagnard tribesmen, a lady and their two kids, and they're very primitive. They wear very little. They just haul their firewood, haul their water. It's a very basic existence for these people. But they are very, very nice. And we went up there, and they're just friendly, happy people. It's amazing to me. I thought at the time, here's a culture that promotes, getting along, and they don't carry grudges. They just exist from day to day. And it's really interesting when a person like us would be in that and witness it. It's just quite something. Now that guy probably had his own tiger stripes that he put on at night and was working for the Americans or the Vietnamese government. But during the day, he just carries his kids around, tends for them, and sees to what he can do to exist. And I took that again with my long lens, so it was a little out of focus. Okay, the old swimming hole, and that old lady's getting out of it. And as I mentioned, it's just a pretty primitive existence. Mm-hmm. Notice that little girl, her teeth are somewhat black. They chew stuff called betel nut,
yes.
And they could sure stink up an airplane whenever, especially if they get sick. This old gal's hauling water, I guess. That's a baby's grave. Mm-hmm. As I said, the mortality rate is pretty high. Mm-hmm. Only the strongest survive there. So when they're born, they feed, and no shots or anything that we're accustomed to, but they're tough. They've got an unbelievable resistance to infection. I found that out when I was stationed in the Philippines. We went out on a hike in outside the base one time with some of our Negrito guides. Mm-hmm. And we came across their village, and this kid had somehow burned his ankle, and he had it wrapped up, and they were wondering what to do. And of course, we told them what to do. And we had some first aid supplies with us, so we left those. But their resistance to infection it would kill us in those circumstances. But with them, they just, they got over it. And a little village, part of the village down near the water, that's primarily Negrito, or Montagnard. But look at all the trees, how they've been, you know.
Such a contrast to...
Yeah, and there's that gal fishing. I had a problem when I was showing this to my 8th graders, but most of them were pretty pretty reasonable, you know. They can see the same thing in National Geographic,
sure.
So... But I thought, golly, there it is, you know.
Yeah.
She's getting fish, so they make do with whatever they can.
Mm-hmm.
And there, she's got a bow, I think, and the kids behind her are about the same way. And so they hunt, they gather, and I guess in some instances they're raising some crops. That's Dale in the middle, the guy I was flying with. Those other two guys were the guys based there. And we had quite a time, but they got a Jeep, one of them. I think the dark-haired guy on the left, I forgot his name. We had all gone through that back U at the same time. Only these guys went through the 01, and I, of course, was in 02. And that's Dale and I. And I've got a print of this picture, but I need to copy all these slides, and I want to get a copy to you. But
is this your aircraft?
That's the airplane we were in that day. Yeah, that's the 01 Bird Dog.
Oh, that's the Bird Dog. Okay.
Yeah, and that's a rather good picture of it.
Yeah.
And I told you about that knife that I had made by that guy here, and I was carrying that, and of course I had a pistol, and of course my rifle in the. In the airplane. On the way back, this is a pretty good picture because it just shows you a lot of what we're dealing with as far as enemy is concerned. You can see the hilly terrain, how thick it was, the river which they used, and they could pull in under any tree and be out of sight, and they. At that time, they didn't have a lot of the technical equipment that is available today as far as infrared and so on. They had some, but that was really, really thick terrain and very hard to cover. And a lot of the Montagnards lived down in that area, but from a standpoint of actually trying to conduct warfare in there, it was pretty difficult. But then again, this is where they stayed, and then they came out of those mountains or hills to wage the war in the south. Now, this again, you can see the triple canopy jungle in the hills, and down in that valley around that stream is elephant grass, and you've heard that mentioned before, and it's very tall, almost as tall as the ceiling of this room. And the facts, the daytime facts, when they would spot a wild elephant down there, they would kill it, because it was said, and I have never seen this any other documentation on it, but that the enemy would get those elephants, especially the younger ones, and train them and use them to haul supplies over the mountain passes and so on. But that is so unbelievably thick that I couldn't imagine being shot down in that mess. I would try and probably stay in the upper layers of the trees until rescued. We're on our way back to Benoit. I kind of like that picture. I'd like to maybe make a big one blown up of that. But this is the monsoon season. And you can see every afternoon the storms build. So we did our little tour in the morning, and we were on our way back. This is another trip here. This is Phan Rang, and this is down on the southeast corner of Vietnam. And this was a very, very weird place. There were people stationed down there, that, of course, a lot of people. But on both sides took this little area for R&R.
Both sides.
So when you saw a group of young male Vietnamese walking along, you couldn't tell whether they're South or whether they're enemy. But it was kind of, as was described to me, I was there on the ground one time, spending a couple of days. But it was just kind of an unwritten truce, you know. It just... it was a good place to just go relax a while, and so they made it over there. I don't know what transportation they used, probably a walk or by sampan or something. But we're flying around, I guess we were in the 01. Yeah, looking out. Yeah, that's an 01. So Dale and I covered quite a lot of territory that day. But we're scooting along, and you can see along the beaches, they built, there's a lot of shacks available along the beaches and the runway, and then you'll see a, that's a ship that was hit and ran aground on the beach there. And I looked at that from the ground, that road above it, and sure enough, it was just a burned out hulk. But you can see the other ships offloading out there in the thing. And that's a little guard post up there. I imagine they got a radar antenna, and they have, you know, you can see several gun emplacements. And, but, and then look along the beach. You can see all the shacks living along the beach, and they have several restaurants. And I made a mistake of eating there one time I was on the ground. It took me a week and a half to get over that. Some of the biggest prawns I've ever, they're that big. And, you know, they assured us they're fresh and everything, but that wasn't quite the case. I was in bad shape for a while. And there's another little hill again with a further built up. You can see the radar antennas. And back at Benoit. I told you, I think the last time, that we had a fly-by-night party. Well, that guy down there is Army, and quite a few of them Army, and this guy was in my outfit, and we scooted around. We talked about this for 2 months. Everybody was flying at night. Of course, it was a party line at night on the radio, and we talked about it, and sure enough, we managed to put it off, and we swapped for things, and we had more food and beer available than you can imagine. We had a couple of half engine cans filled with ice and beer and soft drinks. Anybody flying was limited to 2 beers. And this guy right here, I flew with him one time. He's a country boy, and it just slips my mind, but he's just like one of these actors that was in the, played in a military type environment. And it'll come to me, but not right now. But anyway, this is over at on the southeast corner of Benoit in the residence area, and these buildings that the spooky outfit lived in were called Singapores.
Okay.
And we all got together, Army, everybody. We just went over there and had a real good time. First time we'd ever met people face to face that we had worked with at the night so much, you know, on the radio and one thing or another. And as I mentioned, we had our going away parties and parties in general right first thing in the morning. So, and this is Dave Woolsey right here, and this guy is, his name is Russ Rinkland. He was out of tankers, KC-135s, and this guy's last name is Ormond, and he got sick while he's over there, and I forget, it was something that grounded him. But anyway, his tour was cut short and he was sent back. But we had our going away parties. And this guy's name, he was a navigator. His name is Hank Cast. And Hank was a clown. But I wanted to show you, you know, we all had those little hats made up. And matter of fact, I think this is right out the end door of our hooch. My little cubicle is right inside that corner. And of course you saw sandbags piled all around. But we had just completed, gotten out of a morning party, so Hank's feeling good. And there I am, a couple of our hooch mates. The one on the right is from another hooch. The one on the, yeah, both of them. Our hooch mate wasn't in there. But we got these pajamas and had our rank and wings and sleep down patch sewn on, and that was our partying garb. That is Leia Tron, and that's inside the little place that where she lived with her parents off base. And you see what they use for wall decoration.
That was just like a little restaurant type?
No, it was their home. Okay. Yeah, and she did pretty well because they had a television and one thing and another. And so it's an old GI desk, as you can see. Uh-huh. But this was in her place where she lived. So I don't know where they got the centerfolds to put on them. Well, this guy on the left is Gary Humble, is his name. He was a Golden Gloves guy, fighter. And his hands were huge and very strong. And then Russ was going away. This was his parting shot, I guess. But he was rotating. I think he went to, at that time, Torrejon, Spain to fly tankers again. And we usually wound up, that's Hank Cast again down here, but we wound up getting beer and pizza and stuff like this. Whenever we could. Pizza makings were hard to come by.
I was going to say, how was the pizza?
So normally what we would do is a couple of us would go down to the aerial port and usually grease the palm of a couple of these stewardesses flying in on the R&R airplanes or so on, and they would gather up a bunch of us and a bunch of stuff and bring it in for us when we'd buy it from them. Or somebody coming back from R&R. Buddy Sims, that guy over on the right, he was kind of a garbage gut, but he ordered a knife like mine from the same guy here in Lubbock. And this guy over here, he was my instructor when I first got there. His name was Jay Valentine. And I don't know what happened to Jay when he left there. I think he got out later and went with the airlines. That guy, that major, is another navigator. And you can tell we got a little dizzy at times. Here's a story. This guy's Alex, and I forget his last name because it was so long, but he was Russian descent. While we're in Vietnam, we had the Mars radio setup, military affiliate radio system. And some nights the connections were good and they would patch us on back for home calls. The only problem with that was you'd talk and say, over, you know. So Alex, I talked with my wife several times that way. But Alex got through to his mother one night and she heard his voice and she immediately went into Russian. So he had to go back to English. Mom, you got to speak in English. And of course that was difficult for her, but anyway. And another story about Alex was he was flying in 141s after he left Vietnam. And he was a co-pilot and they were heading up over North Pack. They'd gone to Alaska and were heading down to Japan. And the controlling agency out of Elmendorf called him and said, hey, we got a Russian trawler in trouble. A guy is about to die and blah, blah. Well, it just so happens that they were there and Alex got the frequency of the Russian trawler. Well, it's not going to do you any good. You got to speak Russian. I speak Russian. So sure enough, he contacted them and they went down to a lower level and found him and he made contact with the guy and they were talking and they coordinated. Their mission was aborted and they ordered the trawler and he was there until the helicopters came down from Elmendorf and rescued the guy and took him on back to the hospital. And that was, I thought, kind of interesting. But Alex was quite a guy. And but they were really a good group of people that I flew with. This was an earlier get-together because this guy was our commander. There's a later picture of him. And he was a major, and I forgot his name, but he was just really a good guy. This is Doc Halliday. I told you about that night that was with me when I got the DFC. And Kerry Sharp, that's this guy's name. Kerry Sharp, he acted just like, what was his name? Oh, golly. But his jaw was the same, and he spoke the same, and he acted the same. It was amazing. The guy had been cloned. I'll try and remember his name. This guy's name is Don Shaney, Hank Cass, and I forgot him right now. And this is Carrie Sharp again. See that John over there? Gomer Pyle.
Oh, yeah.
Gomer Pyle. That's who it was.
He does look like him.
I mean, he even acted like him. And he talked like him. It was amazing. You know, and that was before the word clone ever came around, you know. Golly. But anyway, this is a room where we were in the Benoit Officers Club, and it wasn't much of a club. And there's the three navigators. And I flew with all three of them at a time or two. And there's our logo.
Yeah.
Sleepy time. And there's the outgoing and the incoming commanders. And I've got the slide in backwards. You know why?
Why? Yeah, I can see
the wings have to be over
okay.
here. These two are.
Okay.
That new guy's name was Greenleaf, and it'll come to me. I think that's all. Yep.
Okay, this is Disc 2 with Frank Stone. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording about your next to last mission and your last mission.
Yeah, the next to last mission, as I said, it was a rather active night, but nothing out of the ordinary. But then I came on back to the hooch, and getting so close, I had a couple of too many beers, I guess. And next day after breakfast, which was late, I had pulled a mission, my last one, and I even forget who was flying with me as navigator that night. But I do remember that I was in a new airplane, one of the newer ones that came over. Now, it made quite a difference. This was significant because the newer airplanes, you could fly, the endurance was better, they weren't bent. The airplanes had been in country for some time, were really aerodynamically dirty, and we would push it to be 3 hours or 3:15 on a mission with sufficient fuel. And they weren't as fast, and they didn't trim up as good. They didn't fly as good. But this new airplane I was in that very last night, the thing just seemed to fly itself. It was one of those, like that B-17 they restored back at Dover. Its entire history, it just went together so good. And it just naturally flew very evenly, very little trim needed. And it just, the endurance was 3.5 hours easy. Well, this worked out where it was rather good for me, in a way, that the airplane flew so well because it had such endurance, because it just seemed like the Navy had a night to remember. And we were down southeast of Saigon in the rivers areas, and Navy patrol boats were under heavy fire. And I was the one circling Saigon. I was the one available, so guess who got called? So I went on down, and Spooky was off working somewhere else that night. So I had to put in a set of A-37s from Benoit. And as I mentioned earlier, they're the T-37s with the T-38 engines in them and made equipped for warfare. So they had guns, they had rockets, they had bombs, everything you needed. Well, we got a flight of A-37s down there, and we found the areas, and it just seemed the time went so quick. It was so busy. Oh, Lord, it was so busy. We're putting in the set of fighters, and I really forget all the details of what went on that night, but they were really under heavy fire. And I forget if one of them was sunk or what, but I remember I was very, very busy, and the nav I was with, you know, we were working together like quite a team, even though I wasn't really feeling all that chipper. And we managed to really qualify, and the A-37s, they had they were a good outfit. They could really put it where you needed it. And so I think I expended all my marking rockets and my log flares and everything. And I recall that night, I remember how I wish I could get Spooky on scene, because boy, as I mentioned earlier, They broke contact 5 minutes before Spooky got there, and they disappeared into the bushes. But that night they didn't. They kept on firing on those Navy boats, and so it was kind of a busy 3.5 hour flight. And but due to the fact that I was a new airplane and had good endurance and everything, I had sufficient fuel to stay on station quite a while. So eventually we managed to put that one to bed, and the A-37s went home, I went home, and taxiing in, as was traditional, we had to weave around through Ranch Hand and past a couple of other revetment areas, A-1s, and we went down in the center drive to our revetment area. Oh, Lord. There was the whole gang, and they had a fire truck waiting down at the end. Oh, God. I can't remember. I think it seems to me like it was Doc Halliday was my navigator that night. And anyway, so I just started stripping off my survival gear and everything because I was going to get wet. So sure enough, there was Major Greenleaf down there at the end, and he had a bottle of champagne. So I went, I got out of the airplane, and Doc disappeared into a revetment somewhere, and because he didn't want to get wet, and they just rolled me down the ramp with that fire hose. I couldn't believe it. And then Greenleaf brought up the bottle of champagne, and everybody had glasses, and crew chiefs, everybody, so we all toasted in champagne my last night. While I was there, we didn't lose any of our airplanes my whole year, and I thought that was substantial. Because there are many times when we rolled in on targets, and if we really stumbled onto a real beehive, the bullets would fly. And many a night I thought, oh Lord, what am I doing here? As I rolled in, and it just seemed like a wall of tracers coming at me. I think I mentioned this earlier, but the O2 was a good airplane for that job in this respect, in that you could turn the lights off, throw the props out of sync, and do a whiff or deal or two, and they really couldn't tell where you were. So, I'll tell you, it was just, you know, your heart's racing, yet you're doing the job, and every nerve in your body is just so primed to the situation. And of course, when they start shooting at you, then, you know, you could put in usually a set of fighters. They would shoot at us when fighters were on scene, but not when, very rarely when Spooky was around. They just didn't want to mess with Spooky. I just can't say enough for that particular weapon system and the attitude of the guys that flew him out of Benoit. As I mentioned earlier about Ducky Rowe, he was a fabulous commander for those guys, and they all shared his sentiment. If there was something going on, they wanted a piece of it. And it really went very well. But then I was able to leave Vietnam a few days early. I got on the standby list. I was released from duty. So I went down and stood standby with all my bags packed most every evening. And one night, Capital Airways out of Wilmington, Delaware, a Stretch 8 came in, and I saw some of these guys. Well, the bulk of the airplane was loaded with green uniforms right out of the field, and they were ready. And so I managed to get on, and there was another Air Force type or two, so we sat together. And I will never, ever forget, till the day I die, when that airplane lifted the ground, you couldn't hear yourself think for the cheering. It was something. So we came back through Yokota, Japan, Elmendorf, Alaska, we landed at the commercial field at Elmendorf, and then went on to McGuire Air Force Base. And of course, traveling that length of time, I was in dire need, but we got on back to McGuire. And those poor grunts, boy, I'll tell you, they really went through them with a fine-tooth comb at customs. And
most of the Air Force types, they just passed us on through, and I felt that was, but a lot of those kids were pulling, bringing pot back and weapons and stuff like that, mm-hmm. so, but they took quite a while with them, but us Air Force types, they made a simulation of inspection, but then they passed us on through, and then mm-hmm. I went and got on a phone, and managed to find a flight from, let's see, I had to take a limo down to Philadelphia, and I flew out of Philadelphia to Dallas. And when I got to Dallas, I called my wife, and did I mention the ran a flight from Dallas up to Amarillo?
I don't think I did.
There had been a football game in Dallas, and I got on Braniff, and I had a flight that went DFW to Lubbock, and offloaded all the revelers from the football game. Well, that left a couple of people left going to Amarillo, and it's, of course, a short flight, but anyway, the stewardesses were nice, and I was in my khaki uniforms at that time, and I was looking kind of worse for the weather, and there's this old rancher on there, and he came back, and we got to talking, and he says, "I'll bet you're coming back from Vietnam, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he was, got to tell me about, they had a couple of, he was telling me about them, then they're hippies. They had a couple in Hereford. And a couple of the good old boys got together, and they just laid them down, and they sheep sheared them right in the middle of the street. And he said, and he really chuckled about that. But then the stewardesses found out I was back in Vietnam, and they had a bottle of champagne up there. So they went up and got it. And so this rancher and I sip champagne from Lough Damerville, and landed in, at that time I had an old 58 Porsche coupe, and my wife had come down from Stinnett, where she was living at the time, with her folks, down to pick me up, and so we had quite a drive back. After Vietnam, I was assigned to 141s, and I had to go to Altus, Oklahoma, to check out in the airplane, and that was about 3 months.
This was in 1969?
You
left Vietnam in...
very beginning of 1970.
Oh, okay.
January, right after the holidays of 69-70. I had gotten back in November, and I got 30 days sleep, so I stayed home during the holidays. And I can't remember if I went over to Altus before the Christmas holidays or not. It seems to me I might have, because I got back in October. Yeah, I'm sure I did. I was in place at Altus. We got a trailer to live in, and it's in this brand new little trailer park not too far from the base. And that was kind of interesting, because we had a guy, two other couples that we got friendly with. They were young couples. One couple was out of Hawaii, and he was Chinese descent, Spencer Chang, and his little beautiful little wife Arlene, she was Hawaiian, and they were funny. One of the things that brings back to mind was that Spencer liked his sack time. He was sleepy yet. Arlene, on the other hand, could do just fine with 2 or 3 hours a night, and this posed a problem for Spencer, because, you know, he would go to bed, Arlene would stay up reading, cleaning house, whatever, go to bed about 2, get up at 5, haul Spencer out, fixing this big breakfast. She wondered why, because she wasn't getting much response from him. Finally, somebody told her, Spencer needs more sleep than that. And then another couple was Mike and Annie Bottoma, and Mike was from L.A., and he had been to Vietnam also, and Spencer had too. We were all out of Vietnam, and his little wife Annie was French,
And for Annie, I remember watching her on a phone. She was all gestures with her hands. You know how funny, it's funny how some of these things stick in your mind. Well, anyway, after I completed at Altus, then we went on to Mulcord Air Force Base in Washington. I think that's in my bio. And then I got into the 141 and flew as co-pilot quite a while. And then got checked out as aircraft commander. And then I was, most of the time there, I was on the road about three trips to Vietnam a month. And we were all pushing all 100, 110 hours flying time. And when I wasn't flying the 141, why, I was an assistant ops officer there at the in the squadron at McCord. I was in the 4th Squadron, 4th Military Airlift Squadron. And at that time they're called MASS. It's amazing how names change while you're in the military. When I first reported to Dover as a navigator, it was known as MATS, Military Air Transport Service. And then the squadron I was in was the 39th ATS Air Transport Squadron. And then when I got into 141s, then it was MAC, Military Airlift Command. And the squadron I was in was MASS, Military Airlift Squadron. And now it's changed something completely different again. So I guess somebody gets another star every time they change the names or something, I don't know.
Now these trips to Vietnam on the 141, was this transporting
people and equipment?
Okay.
We had, what we were doing normally was flying from McCord, and I'd never forget, we'd get a midnight alert, and we'd be airborne at 3 in the morning. Which meant you didn't sleep much beforehand with the neighbors and kids in the neighborhood and everything. We'd fly usually down to Tinker at Oklahoma City or Kelly down by San Antonio. We'd unload and then go back, and we would normally be land back of a court about noon and then go back into crew rest. Another crew would take the airplane and head on west. Usually we went to Hickam. Sometimes if we were balked out but light enough in weight, we would make direct Wake in crew rest. Then from Wake, it depended again on the load. Sometimes we'd go Wake direct to Clark, or we'd have to stop in Anderson at Guam and refuel and go on to Clark. Then crew rest again, and we would at that time from Clark, we'd normally go in country, Tonsonu, Da Nang, Cameron Bay was a frequent stopover spot for us. But usually one of those three places. Later on, after I left the squadron, a lot of people were going into smaller sites at in 2 Corps, hauling refugees and so on. Then we would come back to Clark or to direct Yokota. If it was AeroVac, it was normally to Yokota. Sometimes we came, it was 50-50 really, either to Clark or Yokota, whoever had the hospital space. And I remember one mission that really sticks out in my mind. We're at Tonsonu. I was aircraft commander then. And I think my co-pilot was John McDonald, a good friend of mine, a young guy. He was a lieutenant, I think, and I was a captain. We were on the ground at Tonsonu. We were configured for AeroVac, and we had a whole load of patients on board. And we just disconnected the air conditioner and gotten the APU running, auxiliary power unit on the aircraft to keep the air conditioning going. And we were put on hold by the tower. They said we got an AeroVac inbound. And so we're sitting right there on the ramp, not too far from the tower. And so they plugged the air conditioner back in, and we were able to keep the APU running.
And we waited about 20 minutes. And looking out over the field, we could see this Huey coming in low. And they had just shut everything down for the moment for this Huey to come in. And it was a dust off. So they told him where to land, right out by the tail. And so we had the rear doors open, and they got this young GI that stepped on mine. And they offloaded him. He had a doctor and a nurse right by his side. Got him configured in a bunk back there. And the doctor and nurse stayed with him. And so he went on there 2 seconds. We shut the doors, cranked up, took off, and went direct to Coda. So from the time that guy got injured to the time we got him to Coda was a little less than 6 hours. Absolutely amazing. And I never did hear any feedback as to whether he lived, died, or what, but mm-hmm. I know the doctor and nurse were with him. And of course we had the flight nurses on board too, caring for the others. And we had a lot of ambulatory in the seats and things like that. But that's a pretty full load that day. We went all the way to Yokota. there was another aerobatic flight. These were the most memorable. the head flight nurse, her name was Stone also. So everybody put, she'd come on giving the announcements, the aircraft commander, Captain Gary Stone, and I am, I forget her first name. But her last name was Stone, so everybody got to josh them about that. But it was that flight, and we had a lot of very hurt people. Mm-hmm. And we'd taken off, reached cruising altitude, and tried to set on the autopilot, and it went, the autopilot was in op. So we had to hand fly that thing gingerly all the way to Yokota.
Yeah. How long a flight was that?
It was about a little over 5 hours, five and a half hours. So we hand flew it all the way to Yokota. So the co-pilot and I we're pretty tired by the time we got there, because we're trying to fly it as easy and gently as possible. So another interesting flight that I was on was one into Nuremberg, Germany, and we had taken one airplane and three crews, I believe, into was it Ramstein? No, it was into Rhein-Main. And we were there, and the co-pilot and I think it was the same guy, John McDonald. Yes, it was John McDonald. We flew together a lot for some reason. And the navigator was this old retread SAC lieutenant colonel who he wasn't really used to the NAC system, And you recall I told you one time when I was a navigator, we got stuck down in Tripoli, Willis Air Base, and I had met this German piano player, Fips Lindschatten. And I said I'd carry on. Well, this was the trip. And we went to the officer's club to eat, and who is sitting up there playing the piano, but Fips. And it had been years since I'd seen him. So I went up and reintroduced myself and refreshed his memory where we first met. He said, "Oh my God, 5 years ago." So we had an enjoyable visit at that time. And we got back to the room about 11. The weather on the East Coast was horrible. And sure enough, 3 a.m, we got alerted. So we had to go down and pre-flight the aircraft, and they usually had a support team in on exercises like this, and this is what this was an exercise. And we were going to haul troops back from Nuremberg back to McConnell Air Force Base in Kansas. And went down there, and the support team hadn't done a thing. They handed us blank sheets of paper to make the flight plan and everything. Well, John and I weren't
completely on top of it. We're doing pretty good. But the navigator, he was still trying to figure out whether he had his shoes on or his boots on. But we went down to Nuremberg. That wasn't really a problem. We got made out a flight plan and got clearance and went on down to Nuremberg. And, of course, at that time it was in the DMZ, the Iron Curtain country. Mm-hmm. And so it required special clearances, special radar tracking, special everything just to get into that area. But we went down to Nuremberg and landed, and they were a real good group down there. They had a flight plan already for us. They really had things on the ball, which we appreciated, and we told them so. I made a good trip report on them when I got back. But we took off from Nuremberg with this about 80-some very tired troops back there, and they were just dragging. And took off, got to altitude, and we're coming back up over Frankfurt. And our clearance read, we turned west at Frankfurt on a certain radial to a certain VOR and on out to the southern England. Well, about 5 minutes out, maybe less than that, out of Frankfurt, this German controller came back, and it was hard to understand him, and gave us a new routing. And we had charts and trying to look out the front and trying to figure it out. And the navigator, I think he was still getting his seatbelt fastened. He was just way behind the airplane. So John and up there, I are up there scrambling, trying to find his place on the charts, you know, what our clearance read. And just as the needle started to turn as we were passing over Frankfurt, I got it. I spotted it. And we made the left turn and headed on. Well, we went from Nuremberg up over Frankfurt, over the southern end of England, and pick up the regular track back to McGuire. Apparently the weather had cleared just enough, or was forecast clear just enough to where we could get in. And so we were one flight, Nuremberg-McGuire. That was a difficult flight, as I remember. It was the weather over the Atlantic really wasn't that bad. And the navigator finally figured out enough, you know, got caught up with himself where he could navigate us across the pond. And so we got back into the McGuire area, thunderstorms and hellacious weather. And John and I were pretty tired by this time, so... And the weather at McGuire was bad. And so there's heavy rain, fog, limited visibility. And so I came in, and I remember this, that the radar controller was, I guess, used to these guys coming out of Germany, because he was very smooth, and he got us on the approach course, and very good talker, and just brought us right in, and it was a near minimums landing. Our minimums at that time were 200.5, and so I was on an ILS backup and a radar approach, and so and finally, you know, we broke out, and sure enough, there's a runway, and we landed, and we were awfully tired, and so we got back to the BOQ, and John just didn't even take off his flight jacket. He just crashed on the bed. So I showered and changed clothes, went to the club, had something to eat. And next day, they called us, and we went on to, took another following flight on to McConnell, offloaded, and then on back to McCord. The 141 years were good.
Steve Bowser, please call 221. Please call 221, please.
We had flights going everywhere. Some of the more memorable ones were down to Australia. And the Aussies and New Zealanders, like I said, were just fabulous, fabulous people. One trip, we went out to Larmouth. We did this normally. The Navy had a big communications tracking site out on the west coast of Australia, probably 100 or 200 miles north of Perth on the coast.
And we used to go into a little strip called Learmonth, and it was normal procedure to come in and buzz the runway about 50 feet and scare the sheep off. They had no tower, but it was a good runway. And there we were out in the middle of nowhere, and so we circled and landed and pulled up. And normally it's about a 2 to 3 hour ground time. They had a fuel truck there and they refueled us. And then the Navy, from their comm site north of the runway, would bring down food for us, and they fed us good. The Navy feeds you well. And then all the Aussies came up to look at the stall at the, and you know, these beautiful little kids, and they were running all over the place. And I remember this little doll, she was a cute little girl, came on up to the cockpit, and we were up there eating or something, and she sat there in the jump seat, and she says, "Do you have to move them all before you can fly?" Those kids were precious, and there were so many of them, and they were just going all over the airplane. We had to shoo them off finally when we got ready to go into a very thorough pre-flight. But we did. Everybody took it in stride, and they were just very, very nice people. And then we'd fly on back to Richmond, outside of Sydney, refuel, and go on to Christchurch in Crewrest. And Christchurch was interesting because normally they put us, it was a commercial airport, and we had to stay in a motel down off the grounds of the airport. And so we get out, and normally the food there was really good. Typical for that part of the country, it was a lot of mutton and standing rib and things like that. And I always just, one of the weaknesses I had, for no matter where I flew, I always enjoyed the local food. Mm-hmm. And flying into France when I was a navigator, I just loved that French restaurant downtown in Châteauroux. And then flying down to Sydney, and Sydney wasn't quite as good as Christchurch, as I remember. Christchurch had some really fine food, and they had really good restaurants in Sydney too. But most of the time there, I wound up going to this little hole in the wall fish and chips place, and you know, eating a lot of that heavy stuff that's not good for us, as we find out in later years. But yeah, it was good. The 141 years, the airplane was just, it was great. I only lost one engine the whole time I was flying, and it was just a precautionary shutdown. But it was very, very reliable. At that time, when I was flying them, they hadn't stretched them yet. And the airplane, all the airframes when I left, were getting up in the neighborhood of 25 to 30,000 hours. And that was from the Vietnam hauls. But they went quite a few years after I left. This was 73 when I left McCord. And they were, I went, I had a job as a squadron commander when I left there. But all the airframes were getting up around 30,000 hours. And then they flew them for quite a few years more before they stretched them. And when they stretched them, they got an extra 3 pallet positions, added refueling capability, and added some other navigational features, INS, inertial nav system. And then, I'm estimating those airplanes, before they stretched them, or at the time they were stretching, had in the neighborhood of 35,000 to 40,000 hours. And then they zeroed them out, time-wise, and then they kept flying them again. And then with the Gulf thing, of course, they were refueling air, in-air refuel. They put as equal number of hours. So I'm estimating now most of the 141s are being retired, but I'm sure those airframes have about 100,000 hours on them. And anybody that usually lost one, it was due to a pilot error. But they had one incident while I was at Travis later on, and I wasn't flying them at that time, but they had one young crew down at
Richmond, Australia, outside of Sydney. Heavy load of fuel going all the way to Learmonth, and maybe Alice Springs, Learmonth. I don't know what his routing was, but it was a rather warm season. I think it was our winter, their summer that this happened. But they had a haze layer that about 200 feet, and it was clear above that usually. But this 141 was taken off this one morning and heading west, and they were just barely airborne. I forget what the altitude was. I remember the particulars, well, all the details I don't remember, but they were not too far airborne. And number three engine came unglued. Rotor vanes, it nearly came apart. Went in through the wing, through number four, into the cockpit, or into the cabin, started fires in the cargo area. And it was a bad situation because the airplane was heavy. They were in a populated area, so they couldn't dump. And the crew did a magnificent job. The loadmasters and the extra engineer were back fighting fires in the cargo hold. And he only had two engines on the left wing, one and two, that were still running. So he had a fire wallet. And they were fighting fire, screaming bloody murder, mayday, mayday, mayday. And he could only turn to the right. And so they got a little altitude, got things under control. But that haze layer, he lost contact with where the base was. The Lord was truly looking out after him. Because an Aussie 130 was coming back into the pattern at that time. And of course, they went and just firewalled it, got over, and led them back to the base for an approach. And they set it down heavy and managed to stop it. And there were no injuries out of that, and the airplane was saved. But that airplane was down there nearly a year. Extensive sheet metal repair, fuel tank repair, full landing gear change. That thing was in bad shape, but it was nearly a year down there before they had it ready to fly again. But anyway, all of the crew members got air medals out of that. And the commander, 22nd there, Travis, it was a Norton crew, if I'm not mistaken, but I can't remember. They were flying out of Norton Air Force Base, which is now closed. But they did a great job. Nothing else comes to mind in the 141 years. I managed at that time to go operational bootstrap at the end of my tour up there and get my college degree at St. Martin's College in Olympia. Then I got an assignment to become a squadron commander at Shepherd Air Force Base. And so we went down there, and I was there a year, or 2 years. We bought a house in Birkenhead, and that was quite a tour, quite an assignment. Probably the most rewarding of my whole career. We had a good squadron, I had good NCOs, especially first sergeants. Boy, those first sergeants were fabulous. We did some good things down there. I started running my squadron the way that, similar to the training I had in the cadet corps, which meant spitshine boots and clean starched uniforms daily, haircuts once a week, and we gave inspections every time for that, and the airmen remembered that for years, but it made a lasting impression on them later on. I would run into them after that. It was just amazing. I remember when I got reassigned to Clark Air Base, I was out there, I was air terminal officer at the time, standing out there waiting for a commercial airplane. and I saw this runway sweeper coming right for me. It screeched a halt, and this kid jumped out, and it was one of my airmen that I had from Shepherd. But they all remembered me fondly, most of them that I recall, that I ever met after that. And all of them did well, but I really tightened the discipline there, and it was very rewarding. Had to put a lot of them out for lying on their applications or whatever, or a little bit of pot use, but running it with that much discipline, I had very little problem. I would have maybe 3, maybe 4 problem areas. Getting drunk or raising hell or smoking a little pot or something. I'd only have about 3 or 4 of those a month, whereas most of the medical outfits had 3 to 4 a weekend or per night per weekend. You know, they were just, it was unbelievable. And they were very proud of themselves. Mm-hmm. From there, I went to Clark Air Base in the Philippines. And I was in the aerial port squadron at that time, 374th military airlift wing, 130s. But I was in the aerial port squadron, and my AFSC at that time was transportation. So for the first year, I was working there as air terminal officer, and so I was just, that was what I ran. And the commander at that time really wasn't he was a non-rated full colonel who really didn't like people with wings on their chest. And so that was a bit of a struggle that one year. And then we had a very nice guy, he was a 130 squadron commander, made full colonel at Pope, and came on to take over the aerial port. And his name was Jim Mayhew. And he was a great guy. He was just fabulous to work for. And I went up and took over the Air Terminal Operations Center, ATOC, for that year. And so it was really the nerve center of what went on in the aerial port. Excuse me. From then, we went on back to Travis Air Force Base. That was my last assignment. I went into the Directorate of Air Transportation, 22nd Air Force. That was the first year I was down in the air terminal operation, or the it was the with the main command post function, the transportation portion of the command post function there at 22nd Air Force. Then I got moved up to the reports and analysis for the remainder part of my tour there. That was the last assignment of my career. And then I came on back down. I had 90 days terminal leave, and I was offered an assignment as the chief of the MAC operation at Rota, Spain, which was Navy base. In a way, I wish I'd have taken it, but at that time, my kids were just starting their teenage years, and I felt like it would be better to retire, come back to Texas, and get them some roots. Mm-hmm. So we landed it on our property up there in Stinnett. I built a house, and they grew up there with their farm animals, and worked out pretty well. And then about 89, we decided we would pull up there. My son's class in school was rather riffraff, and it wasn't a very nice place to live because it was so far from any restaurants, theaters, anything to do. So we moved on down here to Lubbock in 1990, and we've been here ever since. What questions can I
ask? Yeah, if I could back up, I had a few. You mentioned in your slides the Air America plane.
Yes.
How much contact did you have with Air America? Were you aware of their operations?
Not fully. They were more or less spooks. They did what they needed to do. Other than catching rides back and forth from Saigon to Benoit, or saying them out at places like the slide depicted, I really didn't have much contact with them. We didn't work with them at all. But they were there. And as I mentioned, I think in that area where I was living in Benoit, we had CIA guys living there. And they were friendly, we talked, but we really never talked that much about what they did. They were into a lot of very classified stuff. To this day, I don't really know what all they did. I know they seeded the trails, I know they, and the guys I knew at Benoit, that were CIA, they were non-flyers. They didn't really get out and fly any, but they were in the ground. But what they did was all classified.
Okay.
But I know later on they had sensors they dropped along the trails and gravel, and I'm sure you know what that is.
The trail sensors that...
Well, there were trail sensors, and then a lot of their operation involved seeding the trails with gravel. Were you
familiar? I'm not aware of that.
Okay, well, gravel, as I understood it, and I never saw any, never handled it, so this is all hearsay, but it was the rocks that, when stepped on, would blow up.
Okay.
So I think they were involved with some of that, too. But we're kind of far away from trails, and so more of their operation was local.
Okay.
And they never told me, I never asked.
Okay. What about contact with South Vietnamese soldiers or military?
I didn't really have too much contact with the military. Most of the ones that I had contact with were just the civilians around where we lived. I had very little contact with them. My friend out in California, Nick Uren, he was a ground pounder, but he was in transportation over there, and he was mainly around Saigon, and he traveled to different bases, but he worked very closely with the VNAF, and he has a lot more stories about that than I do, but I had very little contact with him.
Okay. And you mentioned you had civilians working on base, you mentioned your hooch maids.
Yes.
And was there ever any concern for your safety with civilians on base, or?
No, we didn't have much concern on that because we knew they were pretty well screened, but there's one time I remember we had a barber in there near the officers' club, and we'd go in there, and every now and then he'd start poking us with a few questions, and and we'd pass it on to the CIA guys, and you know, they would check it out. But whether it's just idle curiosity or what, you know, that he'd probe, trying to find out what we did, you know, and where we're going and stuff like that. So later on, I remember, in the newspaper that came out, the military published newspaper, it had a joke in there one time about this Vietnamese barber back there with the sharpening his, and the guy's sitting in the seat, and the guy's sharpening his razor. Mounted on the wall was, you know, 3 years. But no, I didn't have much contact with them.
And you mentioned also the monsoon season. I was curious, how much did weather affect your missions or your tactics?
Surprisingly, not very much, because normally, since we flew at night, most of the stuff had dissipated enough where the majority of the time we got airborne and managed to go do the job. It was the heat of the day that brought this up and really made them boil. But by the time we got ready to fly at sundown or later, usually later in the monsoon season, it didn't affect us all that much, and I was really surprised about that. Few instances, like that night I got stuck out, yeah, it lasted all night, but a lot of times it would dissipate enough to where we could get airborne and go do our job.
Mm-hmm. What about allegations that American soldiers use drugs? I know you mentioned it a few times. Was that, did you see that as a big problem?
In my particular unit there at Benoit,
I don't think drugs really came into play all that much. The one instance I told you about landing that night at Song Bay, that kid, it was obvious. He was smoking when he was walking down the runway checking it out the next day before we took off. And Doc and I looked at each other and we knew exactly what he was doing. But back in our unit, we didn't have that, as a flying unit, we didn't have that much trouble. We had more trouble with alcohol. Several of those guys, they hit it pretty hard. Normally they would be preparing to go come mission time, but it was noticeable they did drink too much. And yeah. I guess we all did, really.
Do you think that ever affected anybody's capability or?
Well, like I say, we didn't lose any aircraft laws there, so it wasn't really that bad. And usually the navigators were the determining factor, you know. If one of those, usually the pilots were younger, and the navigators were older and more experienced and higher rank. And so usually when the nav saw that somebody wasn't quite fit to fly that night, well, I got called on a lot because I didn't really partake that much. I did some nights, but as a general rule, I didn't. I thought, you know, it's easy to get killed around here, and so I thought I didn't want to really dim my chance of survival by, you know, taking too much. And I usually ate right, and I, as I told you, I was getting over that aircraft ejection, so I was running quite a lot, and so I was starting to stay in fairly decent shape.
Mm-hmm. How close did you follow what was happening with American politics, for instance, Johnson's decision not to seek re-election, the bombing halt over North Vietnam? How close did you follow?
What we were told was what we got off of Armed Forces Network radio and out of the Stars and Stripes. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty heavily censored. So we really didn't know all that much. Guys coming in new in the unit, or that we'd stumble across in the club, they would inform us what's really going on. But we really didn't know all that much, and we were just there doing our job day to day, and the inner workings of the politics really didn't come that much into play. Our main thing was to watch AFN on TV, and the Rowan and Martin Hour was just really our biggest deal of that we could wait for. We really enjoyed watching it. That was a good show, and everybody got a big charge out of that. That I remember that was the main program everybody wanted to watch. And sometimes football or some other sports would come on, and mm-hmm. we'd watch it. But the Rowan and Martin laughing, that left everybody in a good mood. You know, Goldie and Artie and all of those idiots on there, they really, really had a good program.
Did you get to see any USO shows?
Oh,
you
yeah.
Do you remember any of the performers?
A lot of the people that came to Benoit, we had a lot of a little bands would come in there, and they usually had good-looking women dressed very scantily. And I remember, and a lot of Aussie outfits, and I remember quite a few of those. None really struck me as, you know, more than the others. I think I ran into more USO outfits when I was on the road flying 141s. I remember one time we landed at Wake Island, and there was Bob Hope and Joey Heatherton, and that team that particular year, and they everywhere they landed, of course, they gave a little skit, you know, not a show per se, but a little skit, and they go around hugging everybody and you know, just tell them what a fabulous job they're doing. But Bob Hope was a fabulous entertainer, and he just really got people in a good mood.
So you would say boosted morale, definitely.
Oh yeah. But I never witnessed them except that time at Wake Island when I was going through there on an air crew. Mm-hmm. But
While I was in Vietnam, we just had entertainers of a smaller caliber come through. But they tried to hire as many, they tried to provide a consistent system of entertainment. And of course, they had a lot of little outfits mm-hmm. coming around different places. So we had something going on at Benoit quite often. But nothing really, comes to mind as being more spectacular than any other.
Okay. What about racial tension? Was that an issue?
We didn't have anybody in my outfit. And like I said, we were kind of close-knit in the outfit of a minority. Because we were pilots and we were navigators. And at that time, a minority's getting into those really... And we knew that it existed in the enlisted ranks in the Army quite a lot. We didn't really have contact with any units that were having the problems right at that time. Why don't you cut this off?
What about lessons learned from Vietnam? What do you think we, the country or the military, should take from Vietnam?
Well, one of the things that I think is probably predominant that I think most leaders in Washington should acknowledge is you cannot run a war such as that with a 15,000 mile screwdriver. I can't remember if I mentioned this earlier or not, but I feel like President Reagan and later President George Sr. did the right thing on Grenada and the Gulf War. And he said, General, go do your thing. And the generals went and did their thing with very little Oval Office interference. I also feel like, and this is my own opinion, and I can't remember if I mentioned it or not, stop me if I did, but I strongly feel that in the election of 64, if Barry Goldwater would have been in, we wouldn't have had a Vietnam. He was at that time a reserve major general in the Air Force. He was a pilot. He knew exactly how things fell down. It is my personal opinion that had he been elected, Vietnam would not have come about as we had known it. I feel like the lives lost would have been very minimal. I don't think he would have taken this concept of gradualism at all. I don't think at that time we really had much worry out of Russia or China, and he would have just bombed them into oblivion immediately. He wouldn't have done any of this gradualism stuff that proved so costly for our country. Another thing, and this is not going to Vietnam, but I think in the Gulf situation, it is also my personal opinion. I want to qualify this, what I'm about to say, but I feel like they stopped short of Baghdad because the Arab... We have been trying to find logistical supply areas in the Far East for a long time. I feel like President Bush, even though I've never heard him make any reference to it, but I feel personally that the Arab coalition sent word to President Bush that they wanted him to stop short of taking out Saddam. And being a very practical man, I'm thinking that he realized that if we ever wanted to get a logistical supply area over that area of the world, it would probably be better to heed their wishes. I've never seen anything to prove this. It's just a personal opinion. Anything else that you might have questions on?
I don't have any at this moment. Is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, there's one other thing I was going to add, and I can't remember if I told you earlier. Go ahead and shut that off.
Okay, this concludes the interview with Frank G. Stone III. Thank you very much.